to the real estate agency, have asked for some time to present to the subcommittee, and so I would ask them to please come forward at this time. Thank you very much, Senator and Representative, for taking time out of your busy schedule to be here with us today, and we're very interested in hearing what happened on your committee.
We will be the soul of brevity, Madam Chair.
Start in, Senator.
Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I'm the state senator from District 16. Representative Escoval and I chaired an interim committee to look at the operation of the real estate agency, and we were charged with a fairly comprehensive review, the composition of the board, the practices of the commissioner. We reviewed an internal audit prepared by DAS. Our panel was comprised of industry folks, legislators and a member of the commission, the Real Estate Commission. Over the course of the interim, we had a very thoughtful review and have come up with some recommendations that are contained in a report that you are being asked to receive today. Generally, what we discussed, in addition to the issues that I have already raised, were agency responsibilities and operations, and we touched rather heavily on industry concerns about how the agency was performing, specifically with respect to the question of enforcement versus education and the fact that there have been some, I think, very legitimate industry concerns raised. And so with that, we met very regularly. We had excellent attendance. We tried to get our meetings out into the state where people live and work to be able to hear their concerns in those locales, and we've come up with a specific slate of recommendations that my colleague will detail.
Yes, Representative Escobar, District 6. Thanks for having us here today. The first thing that we recommend is that we change the real estate board itself from an advisory board to a policy-making board. In the past, this board has been basically there just to occasionally be asked their opinion and give some input. It's been very, very superficial. There hasn't been any depth into it in the past, and therefore we want to change it from that to a policy-making board. When we do make that change, it's going to be a dramatic change because of several things. These individuals will be the last say on discipline. They'll be have to do with the budget. They'll deal with the budget. They'll deal with future legislation, and they'll also deal with setting policy for this agency itself. That's the first thing.
The second thing is that there was a great deal of concern about the ultimate authority for the commissioner, and it is our recommendation that the commissioner be answerable to the board and that that relationship be very clearly delineated, that the board engage in good governance by having a relationship with the commissioner that would include commission review of the commissioner's performance, and ultimately the commission much more involved in the selection of the commissioner while leaving the ultimate decision to the governor, but the board to have a much more activist role in that decision-making process and oversight process. I think consistent with best business practices that the Ways and Means Committee discussed last session with respect to board performance, governance, and expectations of their execs.
Also, that the board and the agency collectively work towards seeing what this agency is doing. Example, they're taking care of subdivisions and condominiums. They're taking care of escrow officers. So we need to have this board evaluate what is the mission of this agency and to see if maybe they aren't doing things that they shouldn't be doing. Maybe this should go someplace else, or maybe this should go with the insurance agency of the escrow officers as their title does. And I'm sorry I'm getting ahead of you because I understand the industry, but they have to evaluate what they're doing and to look into why they're doing it. That's probably the most important thing, and that board has to be a very hard-working board.
The good news is that two members of the board participated very actively in the task force. We have every indication that the board has already accepted some of the recommendations of the task force. One that I would call to your attention immediately is to include a public comment period in every one of the agendas. I think that there are efforts underway to begin to repair the relationship with the profession that the board serves, although there still is a lot of headway that needs to be made. That really, Madam Chair, members of the committee, is the summary of our work at a high level, because I know in the interest of time you want to move on. You will have distributed a full copy of our report. I think the staff work was outstanding. Sandy did a great job of helping to synthesize a wide variety of subjects that were discussed, and I want to acknowledge her service on the record. And so with that, I think we would be prepared to answer any questions. You will be discussing today in your deliberations recommendation about some additional staffing, and with that, I think we would be happy to take any questions.
Well, first of all, I'd like to commend you. I don't think we've had a better choreographed presentation during the time.
The elbow nudges, we did okay.
That's very well done. And second, to thank you for your service to Oregon on the committee. I know that both of you live a fair distance from the Capitol, and that making those meetings, I'm sure, took way more time than what you just spent sitting in the meeting. So thank you for doing that. Do the members of the committee have any questions? Senator, no?
Excellent job.
Thank you very much.
You bet.
Now, would the agency please come forward?
Could you call? I'll meet with you.
Good morning, and thank you very much for coming here today. Please proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Scott Taylor. I'm the Oregon Real Estate Commissioner. With me at the table to my far right is Katie Cannon, the Deputy Commissioner, Bob Ledoux, who is a board member, and I think you all know Kelly. I hope ours is choreographed as well as the previous one. I wanted to remark to Senator Wesson, he was making some remarks about a sporting event that took place earlier, and I just wanted to say I agree with him completely. We're here today to ask for the November to June operating limitation to allow the agency to continue to operate. Additionally, and I'm going to be very brief on this and try to skip through the highlights, there's some other things that we'd like to do, some of which require some limited duration positions. Our total request is $2,507,701. To look at the budget, obviously we need to continue on to the end of the biennium. And in order to do that, as we've been operating, that would require $1,473,249 in personal services, $593,234 in services and supplies. Now, there's some areas of risk in here, and some of them I'll cover in a bit, but we have some things that we have to do. For one, we have a computerized testing system that for every increase in 20 test applications results in a $1,000 increase to the agency. If you look at July and August, the number of tests that we have are about a 50 to 80 increase over the five-year average. So we're still seeing an expansion of new people entering this business, and it costs us money in order to take care of that. Along with that is criminal background checks. Both those issues, if you'll recall last time we were here, were things that were not in our original budget, and we were going to have to come to you for additional limitation anyway. We're in the middle of a licensed computer migration. I think the safe thing I could say about that is it's been challenging. It's an off-the-shelf program. It's going to take some required changes. We don't know what those are going to be. If you look at the healthcare cost increases. Normally this would have been plugged into our budget, but when we got to the 15-month budget, it became complicated. And we know that we're going to need an additional $17,283 for those. We have AG charges that are yet undetermined because of hearings that we may have coming up, other legal representation, and we just don't know what those are. And we have $13,068 for the Young case for PERS. That were things that those are areas of risk that are going to affect our bottom line. In the area of licensing, that's one of the areas where we're asking for a limited duration position. Why do we need that? Well, we've been experiencing a 15.4% increase in license renewal since 2002, and new licensees since 2000, we've had 188% increase in those. We've tried to keep up with that using temporary employees. DAS has told us that you can't use temporary employees for that. We need to go to limited duration positions. And therefore, what we are asking for there is one position. It's actually for the biennium 0.33, and that's an additional cost of $28,084. In land development, you heard Representative Esquivel talk a little bit about that. That is an area that we have control over today. Condominium filings have increased 55% in the first 6 months of this year, and I don't see any end to it. I asked her, is it slow? Usually it starts to slow in the fall. She's still getting filings. We have a statutory deadline of 45 days to review that. Currently, some of our higher level people are doing lower level work. We're pushing up against that deadline with literally every filing. And so we have that problem. Additionally, that person also does our works on our rulemaking, which we have some of that we're in the process of doing. So what we're asking for there is an administrative specialist one. And again, this is a limited duration position. That would require $25,706. These are all other fund dollars, incidentally. In education, this is an area that Representative Esquivel in particular has been concerned about and expressed to me. Our goal is to get folks into compliance. We have about 3,500 real estate offices and property management offices in the state. And from our surveys and those things, it's apparent that the industry wants us out there doing proactive education for these folks so that ultimately they don't end up in the other side, which is the regulation side, with violations that are causing them grief as well as the public grief. Give you a little history. 1984, the agency reduced their staff as a result of the recession from 74 to 24. At that particular time, going into that, they had an auditing division and they had an investigating division. And the orientation of those folks was different. I was in the industry at the time. The last, what I'd call audit, today we call it a compliance review, that my firm had was in 1981. When I came to the agency, they hadn't had another one, and they finally had one in about around 2000. So that's 19 years since they'd seen somebody there. The firm I left had never had one, and they'd been in the business since 1978. When those were combined, you had investigators doing compliance reviews, and it's sort of like a cop doing something that an accountant would do. It just doesn't work well. So part of what we're trying to do is split that out, and we're asking for two positions there. One will do only property management. The other one will do real estate brokerage, along with one person that we have currently doing that. The property management is a particular concern, as we have property management managers out there, one, who are stealing money, and two, who simply don't know quite what they're to do, and then they find themselves helplessly behind. I could cite you some cases that I'm aware of, but I know that there are some that have happened in Senator Wesson's district, Senator Carter's district, Representative Smith's district, probably yours, and probably Representative Boone's. I'm just not personally aware of those. So we're asking for those two positions, and that's a total of $94,891. We'd like to be able to do what we do better. And what we'd like to do is bring somebody in, take a look at what we do, see if there's some ways that we can improve those things that we're too close to, frankly, to see. And so we'd like to contract with a firm that can come in and evaluate those business practices, and we're asking for $15,000 to do that. The board, Representative Esquivel mentioned that needs to get more involved. I agree that they need to get more involved, and I welcome their involvement, as does the rest of the agency. One of the things they've asked for is the ability to do some surveys and that kind of thing to help them in their decision-making. And so what we've asked for is $20,000, again, another fund limitation. Unschedule that amount until the board takes action, but giving them the ability to conduct some surveys between now and the end of the biennium. And finally, if you look at the real estate industry today, they are very advanced in the use of the Internet to advertise and conduct business. We had six focus groups working around the state, and there was a strong desire for the agency to expand its online services. Today it's minimal. We need somebody to analyze what the needs are, prioritize them, develop a website that'll do what needs to be done, and provide the programming expertise there. And we're asking for $40,000 to do that. I think with that, I'll conclude and take any questions.
Senator Carter has a question.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Good morning. In looking at past information and experience that I've had with your board and you, my question today is, are you utilizing your board better than what you had done in the past as a means of checks and balances, number one? And number two, did your board have a chance to vote on the future directions of where you are going right now, the presentation you're presenting to us today?
Chair Morgan, Senator Carter, I think I can safely say that the board is becoming more involved than they were in the past, and I'm encouraging them, frankly, to get even more involved in that, regardless of what happens in the next session. Regarding the specific proposals, and I'll let Mr. Ledoux speak to that, as you know, some of this stuff happens at the last minute. Our last board meeting was in August. All of this wasn't done. We did send the information out to the board members. Four of them, I think, have responded in a survey asking them what their opinions are. The ones that have responded, I think, are supportive, but I'll let Mr. Ledoux speak to that.
Ms. Madam Chair.
I would be very interested if the member of your panel that's a member of your board would talk to us about the board's knowledge and concurrence with the recommendation of the task force.
Good morning, Madam Chairman and other members. My name is Bob Ledoux. I'm a principal broker with REMAX Equity Group in Portland. I've been continuously licensed in real estate for over 30 years. I've served on the real estate board for a bit over 7 years. And I can tell you that all of the recommendations that were contained in the report that the legislators gave us earlier this morning have been discussed by the Real Estate Board of Directors, and sometimes at great length. A month or so ago, in the absence of the board chairman. I chaired a meeting of the real estate board where each recommendation was, each proposal was taken through one by one, discussed at length, and a consensus was arrived at by those present and by two members who were with us long distance phone, and with one or two fairly minor matters where consensus was not reached, the board overwhelmingly approved the bought into the recommendations that you heard this morning.
Was there a quorum of the board involved in the meeting?
That's correct.
Were motions formally made and adopted?
We had the help at that meeting of a facilitator, since we weren't going for an up or down vote on each one, but rather getting consensus, if that was possible, on the matters.
Yes, thank you. I don't mean to certainly insult either of your intelligence about your work, because you're obviously very respected in your field. But allow me to just say that I think, Scott, you know in particular that we are a citizen-oriented state, and boards are very important. That's where our checks and balances come between the agency as well as the board members. And to not have a voting procedure take place, and since you guys have been so controversial in the last few years about not having active participation in your board, I would think that that would be a priority, and I hope it's something that the Senator and the rest and Representative Esquivel will talk to us about when they come, because I consider that a critical point of passage for me to be able to continue to support you, and I have always done that, as you know. And so I feel comfortable in criticism because I do support you so much of what I consider inaction on the part of the board. Your board needs to be a voting member of things that you bring before this body. Otherwise, citizenship participation means nothing. And so I would like to know that that would be a priority of yours the next time you come before the legislature, that you have an actively participating board that is getting some things done. So, I missed the other part of your testimony. Darn. But, Madam Chair, I'm very serious about this, and I want the record to show and to take note that this, the real estate agency, must have board participation, else the next time around I'll be voting no. And I'll say that very boisterously.
Well, and one of the points that Senator Johnson and Representative Esquivel were very clear in making was that there needed to be a public component to
right.
the agenda
right.
of the commissioners' meeting. And I'm wondering if there was that in the meeting where you discussed the proposal of the task force.
I would say yes, in the sense that there was at least one representative from the Oregon Association of Realtors present throughout, maybe two.
But there was no attempt to get word out to the interested stakeholders that this meeting was taking place and these issues were getting discussed.
Well, this was one of the
input would be welcome. I'm sorry?
Madam Chair, this was one of the regularly scheduled meetings of the board, and meetings are public, and we often have.
And the agenda was available. It was publicly posted and available to people. People knew you were going to be discussing these issues. Katie, could you?
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Katie Cannon. I'm the Deputy Commissioner. On all of our agendas now, we have a portion that's public comment. The agendas are distributed according to the public meetings laws, and then we do post those, and we post the agenda.
Thank you. Any more questions?
And just a record show. I'm seeing and hearing, because I've heard from some of their members, inconsistency here.
I'm concerned also.
Yeah.
Any further questions or comments? Let's have DAS come forward with their recommendation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kelly Frills with the Department of Administrative Services Budget Management. We are recommending a slightly different recommendation than the department's request. It's essentially $110,000 lower than the request of $2.5 million. So our request for other fund expenditure limitation is $2,397,701. In addition, we're extending the current positions by 9.90 FTE, and that extends the current positions through the end of the biennium. We are recommending that they establish the 4 limited duration positions. There were 2 workload positions and then two new compliance positions, and we are recommending both of those. And our recommendation assumes that we unschedule the new money, the compliance money, as well as the website, the business, relook at their business, until after we receive the compliance report and have a better understanding that it meets the needs of what the task force was recommending. So, Madam Chair, that is our recommendation.
Thank you. Recommendation, please. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the Legislative Fiscal Office recommends that the subcommittee recommend approval to increase other funds expenditure limitation by $2,177,513 and continue 30 existing positions. I had written in the recommendation that it was 9.7. PIX informs me that it should be 9.9. So extend those 30 existing positions through the end of the biennium for an FTE of 9.90, and authorize the establishment of 2 limited duration positions to cover the workload issues associated with the licensing function and the land development function. And that will also, this recommendation will also enable the board to continue its operations from the period of November 2006 through June 2007. Questions or comments?
Madam Chair, I'll support LFO's recommendation.
There is, I think, a concern on the part of the agency of having enough limitation for operating expenses. Katie, can you talk to us a little bit about that issue?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, our main concern are some of the risks that the commissioner had outlined, that we are seeing not a decline in the industry, even though they keep saying that the market is softening, and those are things that we don't have control over. For example, the background checks and the testing. I mean, we can't limit the number per month that people can take the test, so we have to pay the bill. Some of the other things, like the Young case and the PERS health, or not the health benefits, are issues that probably we had not considered, and so we know that they are going to be a risk and they will put us over. So it will require us to come back to an emergency board during, or a full ways and means during the session. But we know that those are things, costs that we're going to incur over and above what the LFO recommendation is.
Okay. And can you talk to us, Michelle, about why LFO chose to leave the limitation where it is rather than including money for that, those issues?
Certainly. Madam Chair, the new initiatives that the real estate commissioner was detailing in the request, the evaluation of business processes, real estate board surveys, web development, and the 2 positions for compliance, the 2 compliance positions, it's my understanding that those are going to be included in the agency's budget request as packages, policy option packages, and the thought was that perhaps the Ways and Means Committee would want to evaluate all of the new initiatives in their entirety and see how they all work together rather than looking at them on an individual basis. With regard to these other risk factors that have been pointed out, the thought is that if those do indeed come to bear, then they can return in December at a subsequent meeting of the emergency board once we have a better idea of exactly what those look like and some of those other items shake out.
Yeah, and I think, too, that just to say that I very much appreciate the work that the senator and the representative have done and put into this. I also very much appreciate the work that the commission has done and put into this. This is an issue, as Senator Carter said, that has been looked at a great deal in the session, and there has, I think I would be not stretching things to say that there's been an amount of dissatisfaction put forward about the operation of the agency. And so I think all of us are very interested in seeing how you do as the biennium pulls to a close in the last section of the biennium here. The e-board is available to you if you do have funding issues that you need to look at. You want to say something?
Madam Chair, I think the emergency board is going to be in another month or two and probably be too soon for a really accurate expectation of what the expenses are. So the agency will probably come back as part of their Ways and Means hearings later in the biennium, if that's
well
all right.
Well taken.
I just want
there
that on the record.
There is ample opportunity to deal with the fiscal issues that emerge when the legislature
Right,
comes.
And Madam Chair, Ms. Deister, we had a conversation about this with the agency. She opened that up. That's why her recommendation was lower, because of the expectation that the agency could come back. So I appreciate that being on the record.
Madam Chair, may I please make an unusual request? That when this panel is through, Ms. Jarvis and Mr. Oxley, who have very intimately been engaged in this, with maybe some different perspective from members of that association, be able to present before this committee this morning. I have not asked them if they want to do that, so they may not.
Oh, they're looking like...
They're saying no. Okay.
They're fine.
Okay.
Okay. Any further questions or comments? And I would take a motion to move the LFO recommendation.
I so move, Madam Chair.
I have the motion. Is there discussion on the motion? Is there objection to the motion? Without objection, the motion is carried. Senator, would you consent to carry this in full?
I would.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And we will move forward and call the Department of Justice forward. Good morning, Mr. Attorney General. Thank you for joining us today, and please proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, Hardy Myers, Attorney General, and I'm joined by Mary Williams, who is the Solicitor General of Oregon, the head of our appellate division. And mindful of your request for brevity, Madam Chair, I think that the request letter and the reports of Mr. Wilson, Mr. Friels, really set out the background and the justification for this request in a lot of detail. So let me just quickly sum up two or three key points. First of all, the division's management and its members, its line attorneys, who are involved with the Defense of Criminal Convictions Program have worked extremely hard to try to push this program as deep into the biennium as we could get before we came up against the need to actually cease working cases in the sense of waiving appearance on behalf of the state. I can't credit that management and those members' efforts enough, very sincerely, Madam Chair. But we are now at that point. Now, the legislature has charged my office, charged the Department of Justice, among other missions, to try to be a steady force for public safety and order in Oregon. And one of the most important components of that responsibility is the stewardship of the Defense of Criminal Convictions Program. So I did not feel that I could, in good conscience, start down the road of not appearing on behalf of the state in defense of criminal convictions without making the Assembly aware that we had reached that point, and to invite you to join me in effect saying that is just unacceptable for our public safety program in this state. So that, Madam Chair, in summary, is where we are at this point, and I most respectfully hope that the subcommittee and the wider board will permit the program to have the resources it needs to get to the end of the biennium and defending appropriately each case we must defend during the next 8 or so months.
Other questions or comments for the department? Let's go ahead with the DAS recommendation.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kelly Friels again with the Department of Administrative Services. The request is for $994,819 from the State Emergency Fund, and we are recommending approval of that request.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, we also recommend the allocation of the $994,819 with the request and understanding that the Department of Administrative Services would unschedule that amount and release it as required by the level of expenditures. The amount requested is based on averages and all that, and you know each case has significant differences, and they've done the best they can with the information available for future expenditures, but we feel that unscheduling and making that available as needed is the prudent approach to take.
Questions or comments on the LFO recommendation or the DAS recommendation?
I'm prepared to give you a motion when you get ready.
I move the LFO recommendation, Madam Chair. I mean, Senator Carter sitting here lollygagging around, dragging her feet. And I just want to
I have a motion. Is there discussion on the motion? Objection to the motion? Without objection, the motion is carried. And Senator Westland, being that you made the motion, would you carry?
Oh, I'm sure he's really excited about doing
that. I'm honored.
Let's move on to item 20.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. As with the prior request, I think that the request letter and the analyst's reports set forth in pretty full detail the background and basis for this particular request. Briefly, as explained, we launched litigation earlier this year to defend our settlement proceeds under the National Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement. That defense is necessary because of the onset of what is called this diligent enforcement process, by which each state will be potentially subject to an adjustment in its receipt of revenue from the settlement unless it has been found to have diligently enforced its non-participating manufacturer statute. So the diligence of that enforcement will be the ultimate issue that will be resolved in the litigation. We felt, and in fact all states, and almost all states have filed parallel cases, that it was important to get underway with the process without any delay. And so we have instigated the litigation and have financed this initial phase by a loan from our legal fund to what we are calling the Diligent Enforcement Defense Fund, an internal fund of the Department of Justice. We are most concerned about having the legal fund, which is our working capital account, eroded. And so we are respectfully hoping that the legislature would support restoring at least the expenses to date in that fund as we go forward to work with you, work with the wider assembly to try to determine how we want to structure the payment of the ongoing costs of this litigation. Quite frankly, Madam Chair and members, it's my hope that, as with the cost of the NPN enforcement process itself, the Assembly will determine that the revenue from the settlement should be the appropriate source of the funds to defend the settlement revenue, and that we can successfully work together in the regular session to try to structure an ongoing process for the finance of the litigation that the Assembly can find acceptable.
Questions or comments for the agency?
That was my comment, too, is using the funds to do it. So that's the plan.
Oh,
go ahead. I was just going to add about using the funds. It's very similar to using general fund because some of these tobacco proceeds end up replacing general funds or offsetting it in the general fund budget. So in the long run, it basically has the same effect whether you use general fund or master settlement funds. But the Attorney General is right. That may be the, you know, at least symbolically or whatever, may be the proper way of doing it.
But these are funds that are definitely woven into the budget in the human services arena, and well, I think predominantly that's where they go, but they're not dollars that are just sitting out there not being used. So losing a portion of this revenue source would definitely impact us as we move into the next biennium.
I'm one of the sticklers that says that MSA money should certainly be able to provide opportunity to operationalize the agency, because that's where those dollars came from. And I feel very strongly about that, and I know my friends in LFO might disagree with me that they're general fund dollars, but if they're MSA dollars, then they should be available to do the litigation and other things that they need to be done. We should not equivocate on that at all.
I agree.
Madam Chair, could I just add very quickly that in referring to them as the settlement revenue stream, I wasn't intending to suggest that they aren't general fund. I believe when they come in and are received, they are become part of the general fund. Mm. The distinction I'm trying to draw is between having the cost of the defense of the settlement proceeds spread across the budget, in effect, the general fund, as opposed to having it borne within the Department of Justice, which is what is happening right now, because that's the way we had to set it up in order to get going with litigation.
Mr. Attorney General, you certainly did not say that. That's the senator that said that.
Let's move on to DAS's recommendation.
Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Madam Chair, before we do, just
if I could.
You know, I don't think we as a body nor the state recognizes the department, and in particular the Attorney General, for his dogged pursuit and oversight of the Master Settlement Agreement over the years. It's a long and tedious process. So, Hardy, I want to thank you and your entire department for continuing your vigilance in enforcing the Master Settlement Agreement. Thank you.
Here, here.
Thank you, sir.
Now.
Madam Chair, Kelly Frills, Department of Administrative Services. Our recommendation is that you allocate $827,405 in the State Emergency Fund, and these are the dollars that have been spent through the end of August. We talked to the Department, Legislative Fiscal. We all know that the costs are going to increase throughout the biennium. We don't know what the final costs are going to be. So our expectation is we would pay back the legal fund for the costs to date through August. Ask the Department to come forward at the next emergency board, get an update on what the costs are, make a decision on what additional resources the legislature may want to give the department, and then we'll probably potentially have to do another allocation during the Ways and Means process, if depending on what the decisions are during the e-board process. So with that, Madam Chair.
Mr. Wilson.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, we go along and agree with where DAS is on their recommendation on the spending through August, and also request the or instruct the department to come back at the next e-board to report on where things are. I think that all parties in this would agree that we really won't know where we are because of court decisions in other states driving some of the timing, whether this goes to arbitration or the whatnot. So my guess is you'll continue to see the department at the next e-board and during the session on this very important matter. Keep in mind the revenue stream off this, at least for this current biennium, is over $200 million. So defending this is quite crucial to the financial status of the state.
Thank you. Questions or comments?
Madam Chair, I move the LFO recommendation.
Have a motion. Is there discussion on the motion? Objection? Without objection, the motion is carried. Representative Boone, would you consent to carry this one in the full?
Sure.
And let's move on to item number 21, the Department of Corrections. Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh my! Let's do an eye pour.
We've
got to go get a cup of coffee.
Madam Chair, it's always nice to be recognized by your friends. Max Williams on behalf of the Department of Corrections. Madam Chair, seated to my left is Nathan Allen, who's the Administrator of the Planning and Budget Office. We're really here today to talk about two brief items relative to grant issues and to seek the committee's approval for an adjustment of our expenditure authorization to allow us to spend federal grant money. The first one that's noted on your agenda is a grant that the department received after having sought permission from the legislature to seek this grant, and it's a $1 million federal grant to assist us with the implementation of the Prison Rape Elimination Act. In late 2003, Congress passed a federal act called the Prison Rape Elimination Act, which applies not only to all state and federal prisons, but to all areas where an individual is incarcerated or held in any kind of confinement. And the act has a number of specific requirements, including a monitoring and reporting requirement to the federal government on a regular basis. But the real purpose of the act is to do everything we can within a system to eliminate sexual assault within our prison system and environment. And for the last 2.5 years, the department has been working on an action plan to do that. We believe we've made very important progress, but this $1 million grant, which will allow us to do really three primary things. The first is to enhance the conduct management system in our current offender information system to allow us to track specific information about offenders related to their conduct and activities that will be used for both those individuals who we think are likely to be more vulnerable to assault, as well as those that have either engaged in this activity or we believe are likely prone to engage in this activity. And so that will help us actually monitor the placement of these individuals throughout the department. The second component really is to upgrade certain areas within our system, certainly in our older facilities, where there are areas that we currently are incapable of monitoring because of technological limitations, and there's money that we've identified in the grant for that purpose. And then the third purpose is to train both staff and inmates. Since the implementation of this act, we do a fairly substantial training of inmates upon intake and upon transfer to new facilities regarding what they can do to protect themselves from assault, how they can report. We've established an anonymous hotline that inmates can actually call to report any instances of assault or coercion. And we've also trained our staff to be better about identifying when these situations are occurring. We're pretty good at identifying the violent sexual assaults. That one's pretty easy. It's the coercive environment that is sometimes more difficult to identify, and that's what some of this training is about. We also just recently were the first state in the nation to have some national training on sexual sexual assault response teams, or SART teams, that actually operate inside the institution, and we've been working with the National Institute of Corrections on that. This is a matching grant. All of our match would be in-kind services, essentially, that are currently already being provided within the Department of Corrections that met the grant requirements. So, by and large, Madam Chair, we think this is an opportunity for us to meet the federal statute requirements. We anticipate probably in the next 12 months that the federal government will come out and do a sample evaluation at several of our facilities to evaluate the incidence of sexual assault in prison. That's going to happen around the country, both randomly, and they require a certain number of evaluations at every state, both prisons and jails, and we expect that we'll be part of that in, I would assume, the next 12 months. So that's the report on that grant, and then we have one other brief issue that came up after the agenda that Mr. Wilson can talk about.
Questions or comments? This is your chance.
Madam Chair, I'm just really glad to see this happening, and kudos to Max and his colleagues for being forward-thinking in this issue and not turning a head to it. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
And do you want to talk to us right now about the additional item, and then we'll talk to Daz?
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, after the deadline for this emergency board, the department was notified that it has received or been awarded a serious and violent offender reentry grant from the federal government. The January 2006 board did authorize the authority to the agency to apply for this grant, and it would be our recommendation to include an expenditure limitation increase of $205,000 for the 0507 amount of that $450,000 grant. So in the next session, we would make sure that the 0709 portion of the expenditures for that grant would be added to their budget.
We have DAS.
Here, this one. This one's mine. This one's theirs.
Okay, go ahead.
We're sorry, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. For the record, Linda Gilbert, Department of Administrative Services, Budget and Management. I have a three-part recommendation. The first is to establish a federal funds expenditure limitation of $1 million for implementation of the USDOJ grant for work compliant with the Prison Rape Elimination Act that's just been described. The second part is to request the Department of Administrative Services unschedule 921,896 federal funds expenditure limitation for operations. The reason for that is that limitation was established to expend state criminal alien assistance program grant funds, and those funds have not been received. And the third part relates to my counterpart's description of the late-breaking news about the Serious and Violent Offender Reentry Grant. We recommend that the subcommittee establish a $205,000 federal funds expenditure limitation for grant expenditures in transitional services.
I suspect this is going to be very similar to your recommendation.
Madam Chair, members of subcommittee, ours will match the recommendation of Ms. Gilbert, and just to let the subcommittee know, the increase is an unscheduled. The only reason we're not trying to net this out is that all three of these different items are in separate appropriation lines in the bill, and so we have to do it. This is how we need to do it, even though it seems to add a certain level of confusion or whatever to it.
And Madam Chair, that's why I brought Mr. Allen with me, because he helps me understand that confusion.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Morgan. Good to see you, Max.
Nice to see you, Representative.
Do we have any quantifiable data on how serious this issue is within our prison system, or is point number one going to help us address that?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, we do have some data, and the department was even thinking about this prior to the passage of the federal act. We had done our own internal research that had been conducted the year before I came on to the department. It was finalized shortly after I was made the director, that reflected that we have a fairly low amount of reporting of prison sexual assault. As we looked at the data, however, from the research that we did and where we had some outside folks come in and conduct some interviews with inmates, randomized approach to try to determine the event, what we found was that in a system that has about 13,000 or so inmates, that there was what we would expect in a annual period, about 175 cases on the outside, which was a significantly higher number than was actually being reported, but as a percentage was a significantly lower number than was being reported nationally on the national statistics. What this told us, and I think what people have learned as they've delved deeper into this issue around the country, is this is a very hard thing to get a handle on, in part because there isn't always a distinction depending on who you're interviewing about what actually constitutes a sexual assault. The issue of consent in a prison environment where there are issues of coercion and the like are very, very complicated. The federal government has spent a lot of effort in trying to develop an approach, and the approach that they'll bring into our system when they come in and do these randomized studies in our own system will include a video terminal in sort of a separate area where inmates can come in and take a survey on a touch screen and with kind of complete protection around what they're going to report. And this is the, 2 years worth of work that they've done to try to figure out the best way to get people to actually talk about this issue. It's much more complicated than just identifying the reporting piece. I mean, we're really focused on kind of a zero tolerance and prevention policy. So a lot of our efforts are going to how do we identify likely perpetrators, how do we also identify people who are likely victims given their vulnerabilities, and then how do we make sure that those two groups of people don't interact within this environment? And as you can imagine, that remains somewhat of an elusive challenge, but we continue to press.
Do you see additional federal funding then coming down the line as this initiative moves forward?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I hope we do. I hope we do. I know that there is this legislation in 2003 was passed overwhelmingly by both houses of the Congress and signed by the President. There's a Presidential Commission on the Prison Rape Elimination Act that continues to work on this issue. The U.S. Department of Justice under the Attorney General's office is in the process right now of establishing a set of national standards which they're going to apply to the states. And my hope is that when the time comes to apply these national standards to the extent that they create or place additional burdens on correction systems throughout the country, that the federal government will also identify some funding opportunities for states who might need either systems upgrades or physical plant upgrades or other things that might be part of those national standards, that they would have some funds available for us to help achieve that. But we were just grateful to be one of the states selected for the $1 million grant. This alone will really take what we've already been doing and really allow us to sort of operationalize some of those efforts. You bet. My pleasure.
I'd take a motion to move the LFO resolution.
Madam Chair.
It's a discussion on the motion. Objection to the motion? Motion is carried. Representative Smith, would you carry this in the hall? Thank you.
Thank you very much, members.
Thank you very much, Director, Mr. Director. And we will move on to the Department of State Police. Uh-huh. Another refugee. Good morning, Mr. Superintendent. Please proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ron Ricker, Superintendent of the Oregon State Police. It's our pleasure to be here today to report first on the agency's vacant and double-filled positions and on the agency's financial status. You have, I'm sure, each received a copy of our letter updating you all on the vacancies and the double fills. I think I'll save that for the second part of this and speak first about the financial status, if that meets your approval, and that is that we continue to monitor some very sizable and unexpected issues or factors affecting our budget. Most notably the price of fuel, and also a significant court decision that could affect us by as much as about $1.7 or so million dollars. That'd be the Young versus the State of Oregon case. We also have some wildland fire costs as a result of the Conflagration Act for fires that were fought both last fire season and this year so far, and we are looking at all of these things with the knowledge that we may need to come back, especially with respect to the fire costs, come back, and once this fire season is concluded and we can tabulate what all that is, it's been our practice, and we'll hope it'll be acceptable to the committee that we come back when we know what the total of that is and come before you and discuss that in one conversation about both years' fire costs and do it all at one time, and we're not quite out of the woods yet with respect to this year's potential fire costs or tabulating the exact cost of what has been expended this year. But so those are the three issues that we're really watching. We also know that we're going to need to expect that we're going to need to come back in to rebalance our budget. At this point, it's not certain whether we'll need any additional revenue. In fact, I would say, based on what I think we know today, the answer is we would not need revenue, but for potentially the fire costs. But we will probably be coming back before you in potentially the next meeting of the E-Board and talk to you about our need to move resources around within the silos of the agency. But based on what we know now, we felt it was premature for us to try to rebalance at this point because there just I didn't want to have to do it twice. I'd rather come back at a time when we're more sure and discuss that with the legislature and proceed together from that point. So that's our, that's where we sit at this point with respect to our finances. As to vacancies, we have the spreadsheet that I think the committee is getting pretty familiar with in terms of format. We have another updated version of that. In a nutshell, we are running today, and everyone understands this is it's always a point in time when one takes a snapshot, so things can move by a position or two, you know, in between the time we submit a letter or even update a sheet. But this gives, I think, a good sense of where we are, a very good sense of where we are presently. Running about 25 vacancies on the professional side of our shop and a net of about 14 vacancies and 14 or so vacancies in sworn officers. Those on the latter part, all the sworn officer vacancies, we expect to fill trooper vacancies with the next recruit academy class, which we think will be. And that's the other thing we're going to report on later is our integration of training with DPSST. The first class that we have jointly with DPSST and State Police Basic Recruit Training will occur with DPSST's, we believe, February class. We will hire to the number of vacancies we have at that point, and that will fill the trooper vacancies that you're seeing on this sheet. So we have a class that graduates tomorrow at Camp Brightlea, and then we'll do the next round of hiring in February. So we continue to run some vacancies in the sergeant's positions for a variety of reasons, which we've talked about before, and continue to have some difficulty recruiting for certain sergeant's positions. In some cases, we've made a judgment that we need the person on the front line more than we need the manager in a couple of situations, and I'll continue to do that until we know we're going to have the front line positions filled. Every time I promote somebody to sergeant, that leaves a hole someplace on the frontline work schedule in some division. And so we got to know that recruit is either in training or coming to training before we move too quickly to fill the management position. So
the class that is graduating tomorrow,
yes, ma'am.
Can you talk to us about the attrition rate for that particular class? I think that's one of the things that we've had an ongoing discussion about. I'm just curious how this one worked out.
We started with, staff can correct me if I get a number wrong, I think we started with 34 for the state police. And we also had six local law enforcement people in the class, which is the second time in 3 years that we have done that, invited city or county agencies to send some of their people through our school. This was this time at the request of and in partnership with the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, who was having a waiting list or, capacity or space problem in our academy.
But the state police part of it, how much did it start out to be?
34. We're graduating 28.
Okay.
So we lost six, which is the same. I think that's the same number as the last
time. Pretty much holding the same percentage.
Two times, these last two classes, it's been about six that we lost, and historically you would have thought two or three. So we've had there are a variety of reasons, whether they be medical or physical, or in some cases people just said, this isn't for me, I need to leave. And mm-hmm. we've had that this time, and we actually always have some of that, but this is the second time we've had a bit more of that than we historically have. So that's how we fared on this one. I'd be pleased to answer questions from the committee about vacancies or the finances or whatever you'd like to talk about.
Well, I'm just curious. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious about when you say the reasons and people say this isn't for me. Do you see any correlation among the current events involving police officers and your, these are brand new people to this in some cases? Do you think that affects people's thoughts?
Madam Chair, Representative, I certainly could. I haven't had any discussion specifically with them to be able to verify that. I will say that over the course of time, that I'm not sure that's a new phenomenon, because we've always had, attacks on police officers and violent events that have occurred in the state over the years, including during when we were training recruits and we didn't know those people so much then. I don't know. And I hesitate to speculate.
I was just curious. Yeah, thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Morgan. How many canine units do we have?
How many canine units?
One in Salem, Medford, Central Point area.
Could we get you to come forward and we'll get this all on the record?
Sorry, Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Tim McLean, Lieutenant Colonel in charge of operations. Madam Chair, Representative Smith, again, to start over, we started out down back in the Central Point area, getting back into the patrol canine program on narcotics enforcement. And since that, we've expanded. We now have one located in the Springfield area, Salem, and we're looking at the 97 IA4 corridor right now.
You feel like that's adequate?
No, but we're building slowly on this, both for budget reasons and personnel.
The reason I raised this issue, committee, is a month or so ago I had an opportunity to do a ride-along with OSP, and one of the issues that was raised with me is when an officer feels like, through their experience, through their professionalism, that there's an issue in which a canine unit is needed, it's imperative that that canine unit be available within a very quick period of time, because you can only detain, I believe, for, is it 20 minutes? Something like that. And so if you're out in a remote part of the state of Oregon and you need a canine unit and one's not available within a quick period of time, an officer loses an opportunity, a potential opportunity, to do the job that they're paid to do. And I think as we look at the staffing of OSP, I think it's incumbent upon us to look at making sure they have all the tools they need. And I know out in rural Oregon, that includes canine units.
Madam Chair, just to follow up, Representative Smith, forgot one, Pendleton. Hermiston area, thank you. The other thing is that we have to be careful here is our policy. We basically want at least two officers out on a search for officer safety reasons. The other thing we're in the process of, and actually, Madam Chair, it's going to be probably in your area, we're looking at partnerships with local agencies. In this case, will be the sheriff's office down there is looking at moving forward with a canine. And if they, then we could work together and use each other's resources that way.
Just one quick follow-up comment, Madam Chair Morgan. If you're on the coast or in a remote part of rural Oregon, it could be hours before a canine unit's available or backup assistance is available. And, you know, we're putting tremendous pressure on OSP, and yet we're handcuffing one arm behind their back and asking them to do their job. And I think it's very incumbent upon us to realize what we're doing to this agency. Thank you.
You look like you need to say something, Mr. Chair.
I could go on and on, Madam Chair, but I think I'll just wait and respond to the next question.
Okay, further questions or comments? Let's go to the LFO recommendation on this one.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the subcommittee, again, Linda Gilbert, DAS Budget Management. We recommend the subcommittee acknowledge receipt of the report.
And Mr. Wilson?
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, we agree. We recommend acknowledgement of the report, and just a couple other signs of notification here as we continue sort of regular discussing with Ms. Brown the financial status in the past couple weeks. Had the most recent report on that, and at this time I agree with the superintendent that, you know, even given the unknowns, it looks like they're, you know, right at the threshold of staying even. And in addition, on our regular handout on terms of vacant positions, not only at the department-wide level but individual divisions, this isn't out of line with usual vacancies across other state agencies, and they do try to make an effort now in terms of balancing between agencies, and as jobs become available in Fish and Wildlife or Criminal, they do internally advertise for them and fill as candidates come forward.
Thank you. I have a motion to move the LFO recommendation. Is there discussion? Objection? Without objection, the motion is carried. Senator Carter, would you consent to carry this one in the fall? And then let's move on to item number 23.
This is our report on our integration of training with DPSST. I hope that's number 23.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I'm here, members of the committee, for the record, Ron Rickers, Oklahoma State Police, and I'm here to report on, with Director Minnis of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, on our efforts to combine the 16-week training curriculum of DPSST with State Police Basic Recruit Training. We are on schedule, as the letter lays out, we are on schedule to be fully integrated into the DPSST training program. I believe with this 14 or so positions that I mentioned earlier, the number will probably change by a couple, one way or the other, but in that range of candidates into the DPSST school beginning, is it February 5th, John? February something.
February 5th.
And we're going to be there, and that's our plan. We've worked closely with the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, and we are on track to accomplish that integration exactly as we were directed to do. So I'll be happy to answer questions about that if there are any. Oh, I guess I have also to report on our continuing use or lease with Camp Rylea.
Mm-hmm.
We have terminated our lease with Camp Rylea, but continue our full-time lease of the facility down there, but continue our discussions with the military for what we anticipate will be the continued occasional use of Camp Rylea for specialized training that cannot happen at Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, and also for about 4 weeks of State Police-specific recruit training that we, at least in the first instance, intend to do at Camp Rylea. To cover subjects not covered in the DPSST Academy training curriculum. So we will continue to use Camp Rylea or possibly some other facility if we need to for the things that cannot occur at DPSST. This is understood and agreed to by both our agencies, and that's the way we continue to proceed. So we've terminated this full-time lease of the facility at Camp Rylea. I'd be happy to answer any questions about that.
Would you agree to defer questions until Director Minnis makes his half of the report? Please, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Excuse me, Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay. Senator Weston isn't here to welcome my colleague. He's here. Ooh, I think I better walk out.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, my name is John Minnis. I'm the director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, and the department is here in concert with the Department of State Police. We co-authored the letter that has been submitted to the Emergency Board on the integration of the Oregon State Police Academy with the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. The superintendent is correct. The Board on Public Safety Standards and Training, which the superintendent is a member of, and subsequent policy committees, the Police Policy Committee and a subcommittee of the Policy Committee dealing with curriculum, have worked for many months in concert with each other, overseeing and viewing the various subject matter areas of the 16-week curriculum. And so they have participated actively with that subcommittee. That has been approved. The 16-week curriculum has been approved by the Policy Committee, and on October 19th of this year, the full board will hear a presentation on what that 16-week curriculum will look like and issues discussed here today, and we expect the approval of the board at that time. So I think both the superintendent and I are confident that we're on track. We're working in partnership, and I think in concert with each other. And frankly, from my perspective, thinking about some of the issues raised by Representative Smith and others and recent things in the news, that there really is no way that one police agency, be it state police or local jurisdiction or the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training as a training organization, can really meet the needs for training or for the deployment of various types of tools necessary to meet the complex situations and issues that officers are finding in our communities without partnerships, without cooperation, and without working together and kind of letting some of those
those barriers down, and it really extends beyond just our involvement with police agencies, but it includes the Department of Corrections and other public safety agencies, parole organizations within counties and so on and so forth. So I think that that's one of the new trends, if you will, within public safety, and I think the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training is doing the best we can to incorporate and include as many of our constituents as possible to criticize, to be participants in the development of the curriculum. It's kind of bleeding into my next presentation, but I think that what the committee needs to understand with respect to the 16-week curriculum, in addition, is that it is not a product that will be finished and we'll say, this is it, and it's never going to be reviewed again. The idea is that it will be a constantly evolving curriculum that will be reviewed by the board and the policy committee and curriculum subcommittees over time, because what we do know is that tactics and our experiences have to change and we have to be able to adapt to the times and the tactics that some of our bad guys and bad girls are deploying against public safety officers. So we need to be at least as smart as they are.
Questions or comments for the superintendent or the director?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to comment. This is now, is this 16-week curriculum replacing the 21-week OSP curriculum? And if so, that's a month less. So what's going to be taken away from?
Madam Chair, and let me respond, and the superintendent, I assume, will agree he may not. But I think that it must be outlined for the committee that the 16-week program is the basic training curriculum in the various subject matter areas that we believe are critical to the foundational knowledge that all public safety officers need throughout Oregon. It is not unusual or inconsistent with current practices that agencies, in particular large agencies, have subsequent advanced academies or advanced training procedures as their budgets and local governments will allow them to do. For instance, the city of Portland, we currently have a 10-week basic training program. When their folks graduate from our program, they go into a 16-week advanced academy with their city. The subject matter areas are a little different. They're mostly agency-specific. Rules, regulations, tactics, how to fill out your timesheet, what the expectations are within the agency. But they might also add addendum training or additional training in subject matter areas for perishable skills and how the tactics might be deployed for, say, felony car stops or other kinds of encounters with violent suspects. So there's a little bit of overlap. Most of it would be additional training materials. It's intended to improve the skills of the officers coming back to the agencies and also agency-specific material that the agencies believe are important to their various agencies, and superintendent certainly could.
I guess commenting on the most recent shooting of the young man in Portland, and hope that the curriculums, and you know, if BPSST is going to be doing the bulk of it, because this happens in rural areas too, where we rely on our state police. But I'm really concerned about the level of training. And in this particular case, the two officers were freshly minted, I believe. And in a case like that, where you would think you would want someone who has a little background in dealing with behavior issues or mental illness or whatever it might be in terms of how it's handled. And I started looking into this and looking at how the military handles things like this, and got some local input from a guy who keeps up on current events and commented on the fact that in the military, very drunk sailors, for example, are dealt with very differently, and they don't carry weapons. But in this case, is, you know, could you look at something like, and I'm not a police officer, I don't know all the things, I do understand the risks that this particular case may have faced, but it seems to me if you know, aim for an extremity might be a more appropriate response to something like that. So I just wonder if that's going
to
be.
I really hesitate to put these folks in a position.
No, I know.
On a situation that's currently under investigation.
Right.
So
I was just commenting on that and just hoping that an approach, including training in mental illness and other types of issues where you might find something like that is included.
Do you feel I don't want to put you in a place where
I understand.
Madam Chair, to comment
I'm very on comfortable like responding generically without, because I would say that each and every circumstance that an officer finds themselves involved in a deadly force situation, it would be prudent to look at the factual circumstances that are best reviewed by grand juries and legal experts that are looking at those circumstances. But I can tell you, and Representative, you commented, aiming for an extremity might be a better tactic. We've heard that before. But what that really says is you need more training. Now, if the expectation would be that an officer should be capable of aiming for an extremity, which I would probably have some reservations about the utility of that in terms of its application in a violent confrontation where your fine motor skills are diminished because of the stress and this kind of thing, I think it's unlikely that those kind of skills can be reinforced to an extent that you could rely on them given that tactical situation ongoing. But what it really says is that there does need to be additional training. For instance, the involvement in the crisis intervention, training people to deal with mental health issues, which we'll talk about in the next report, are all issues that the Department of Public Safety stands in training, the board, the policy committees are acutely aware of and very concerned about. The issues that we face are the constraint of 16 weeks and various budgets that do exist within the municipal governments and within the Department of State Police for advanced training, and each of those attempts to try to improve those training environments cause us to incur additional costs, venues, subject matter experts, and it's not that we don't want to do them. It's a logistical problem. We'd love to do it, and it's also costly. We do believe, quite frankly, once we get the 16-week program fully operational, at that point we're still 8 weeks behind the national average for basic training police academies in the nation. So although we believe that what we're doing in the department is substantially superior to what's happening in most other states, and I believe that we can actually verify that through legitimate academics who reviewed the program that we're deploying, we still believe that we are in need of much, much more training, and it all costs money.
Just a final comment, and I'll be brief. I appreciate that. Thank you. And I know that things are different than they were 100 years ago, and the issues that you're dealing with and the types of problems that you face. So I totally understand that. Well, thank you very much.
Mr. Director, I was curious. I was surprised to learn that so many law enforcement jurisdictions continued their training beyond the core course that DPSST offers. Are there jurisdictions in the state that don't offer more training, or is it standard that they all do?
Madam Chair, I couldn't have set you up with a better question. The fact of the matter is that most law enforcement jurisdictions throughout the state are small jurisdictions, having, you know, 1 to 5 police officers. Most of the advanced training or training that goes on post-basic is delivered by the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training through our regional training program, where we have 5 regional training coordinators that coordinate that training. We do a pretty good job with the resources that we have and the utilization of the range 3000 equipment and other materials that we have for perishable skills, emergency vehicle operations training, etc. But in most instances, we are the only training component post-basic training that those organizations can offer. So it is a critical component. Again, another reason to work in partnership with our larger organizations, and actually those discussions are ongoing as late as yesterday afternoon with a conversation with the Portland Police Bureau that are looking to try to find a regional training facility partnership program of some sort to bring in other agencies to continue training, and now understand that it's necessary to bring in other agencies to participate with them to make that work. It is a huge ongoing need, because we use the phrase perishable skills constantly, because we can train, and I was once competent at doing the PIT, remind me what PIT stands for pursuit intervention technique, which is taught in pursuit training. I think I could still do it if I had to, but I don't believe I'm competent at it. It would require me to go back and get a refresher course to make sure that I'm up to the current techniques. The vehicles that are being deployed in law enforcement have changed substantially from the Ford Interceptor that has certain physics in the vehicle designed into their engineering, very different from the new Chrysler or Dodge Chargers that have a very different suspension system and can create a substantial difference in how the car reacts in a pursuit situation or pit training exercise. The point being that to the extent that I once knew those things, my skills diminish commensurate with my inactivity. So it's necessary for me to go back and retrain on emergency vehicle operations or PIT training or firearms training or defense tactics training and so on and so forth. And, you know, we have a lot of officers who've been on the street for a long time who have not had refresher courses, who have not been back out there again. And it's a huge problem, and it unfortunately can result in very tragic events occurring.
Chair, members of the committee, I agree with all that John said, but need to add to it, and that is that in a centralized academy setting, whether it's the FBI National Academy or police academy in a state, it is absolutely true that academic subjects and perishable skills trainings, defensive tactics, firearms, etc., can be, are taught, can and should be taught consistently to all law enforcement agencies in a setting like that. What's not taught in a setting like that is the agency's own administrative policies, procedures, protocols, and they vary greatly with the mission of the organization, and that's the core of what we intend to train beyond the 16 weeks that will happen in partnership with DPSSD. Is the state police policy and procedure manual, which that's we've got to get that delivered academically to our employees before they go out on the street, and so that is not all of it, but that is the bulk of what when an agency conducts its own training. As John mentioned, just some examples of silly things like basic things like how to fill out your time card and other administrative sort of procedures that vary from every agency to every agency, then you have to do that sometime. And you've got to do it, in my view, right out of the chute when they're first hired as new employees. So we intend to accomplish in this training that will wrap around the 16 weeks of what is the core academic and skills training at DPSST is the agency-specific things that a third, that another agency just couldn't possibly teach our employees what our internal policies are. So with that, I'll be quiet.
Well, let's move on to Dennis's recommendation, which I think is going to be very short.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, Linda Gilbert, DAS Budget and Management, would recommend the subcommittee acknowledge receipt of the report.
Thank you. Mr. Wilson.
Ditto.
Yes.
For shortness.
And I will take a motion to move the LFO recommendation. I have the motion. Is there any discussion? Any objection? The motion is carried, and I think it's my turn to carry something, so I'll take this one. And we'll move on then to item number 24 and talk about the status of the training curriculum. We kind of covered a bunch of it, so this should be really short.
Madam Chair, I get your message, and I assume
thank
we're
you,
talking.
Mr. Superintendent.
Talking primarily about budget note number 2 in House Bill 5136. I believe the committee members did receive, unfortunately, I do apologize for the length of the report. We were asked to report on a multiplicity of things. We have talked about the curriculum development, so I will bypass that unless members have specific questions. We talked about perishable skills listed in my report, use of force, pursuit driving, defusing hostilities, responding to persons with mental illness, progress on curriculum development for first responders, et cetera. One of the things I do want to mention as a footnote is the new 16-week training program is really predicated upon a change in paradigm. Most of the training is currently occurring in an academic seat time, you're sitting in a classroom listening to an instructor, a series of instructors, or you're involving yourself to some degree with the skills training. Our scenario-based training really envisions a progressive, interactive, interdisciplinary training that culminates in the 16th week with what we're calling Calls for Service Week, which are practical skills and scenarios that will be as real as we can make them, so that the officers hopefully will be riding along with the very field training officer that they're going to be going back to their jurisdiction and working with and responding to mock robberies, mock assaults, mock family beats, et cetera, et cetera. And as many of these kind of scenarios as we can potentially deploy and make realistic. The idea is to put these officers under stress in as real a climate as possible, potentially with having their very calls being dispatched from a dispatch center, perhaps in Roseburg, that can patch into our dispatch center at our site and use that multidisciplinary approach. What we find is that through the practical application of the knowledge they're learning in classroom, they retain over 80% of that information as opposed to the standard research that shows about 8% of academic training in a classroom is retained once somebody leaves. We do have other additional issues, major accident investigation, training that continues. There is growth in all of our 16-week program addressing these issues, but again, we're constrained by the 16-week. Cultural awareness and diversity is an issue that the agency cares deeply about. One of the things that has happened there is that the agency is working with the Law Enforcement Contacts Committee that is being administered through the Hatfield School of Government at Portland State University. That group has integrated with us and helped develop scenarios that hopefully meet their expectations with respect to scenarios that are addressing issues of cultural awareness and diversity. And the good thing about scenarios is we can build in almost any kind of contingency that you could possibly imagine or experience in the real world, and then we can debrief post-scenario to address whether or not the officer appropriately responded. I'll move on now, if I can, just at the construction of the facility. I can sum it up pretty simply by saying that we are on time, under budget. We moved in July. We were expected to move in October. We have been blessed by the benefit of a project manager, Richard Ross, who came to us from the Department of Corrections and was responsible for building the last five major construction sites. We utilized the CFGC, Construction Manager, Construction Contractor Exemption Process, to work in concert with Hoffman Construction, YGA, Geos, Greeby Hall, architects out of Portland, along with a myriad of other contractors. Most of our contractors came from Oregon. I believe it was over 90%. We tried to increase our participation of minority contractors in the state, and with the cooperation of Hoffman Construction, we were not able to meet our goal of 15%, but I believe we ended up about 6% minority participation. We actually lost a portion of that percentage because one of the contractors lost their certification, and it changed the numbers a little bit. Bottom line, as we've moved into the facility, we're now going into operational mode, developing policies and procedures for that particular site. We welcome your participation in coming out. We're glad to show you through the facility, show you what we're doing, what we're intending. In fact, we like to show it off. We think it's cutting edge facility in terms of the ability of things that we can do there, and it has been validified to some degree by the University of Edmonton, Canada, and a professor who studies these very issues, who's come down and issued us a couple of reports saying we're basically about 10 years ahead in terms of the kind of strategies that we're using of any police training academy anywhere in the world, including Northern Ireland, the Metropolitan Police Department in London. The Edmonton Police Department is now looking at using this facility and its venues and the models for training as a model for their own training. Thank you very much. We're moving on. Again, I said I'd like to.
That's a very complete and comprehensive report, Matt.
Thank you very
much. It's very fine.
God bless you. et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
But, Madam Chair, it's something that the legislature has to stop overlooking, and I'm so proud of John for bringing it before us. Number one, the weeks of training. Senator Gorvey and I have tried to work on that for a long time but could not get the legislature to move in terms of the allocation of dollars that John would need to do that. And he didn't pay me to say this either. This is something I've been very interested in. And our law enforcement across the state, period, has no training and dollars allocated to them to deal with mental health issues.
Mm-hmm.
And 20 years I've been talking about this. We cannot expect our police to continually put themselves on the line and take chances on getting hurt, like in Clackamas this happened, but in Clackamas also the wonderful policeman that was shot in the face by a kid. There are so many things that put them at risk, but at the same time, if they had training and they had a particular group to go out when you know there's a mental health issue, it can be done. So a lot of that is an issue of society and certainly an issue of budgetary means from the legislature. So, John, I hope you'll still keep giving reports of this nature in terms of those two issues in particular, as far as law enforcement officers need to have the training in order to practice safety for their own lives.
Well, and I think also one thing we don't do is say thank you very mm-hmm. often, and I would just like to say thank you for bringing this project in mm-hmm. on time, under budget, and with a great wide consensus group of people being very excited about seeing this unfold. So thank you.
Yeah, sure, thank you, and it's certainly not just me. I've got a great team of individuals that have worked just tirelessly, and I'm very, very, very proud of the work that they've done. Great people.
And let's move on and have DAS give us their recommendation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the subcommittee, DAS recommends the subcommittee acknowledge receipt of the report.
And Mr. Walker, this I understand is your first appearance and before us an EBIRT subcommittee in this capacity.
Yes, it is.
And I'm assuming that the contract has been signed so he can't get out of it.
I'm kind of committed at this point.
Welcome aboard.
Thank you.
I hope that you appreciate the kind of craziness that we get involved in here and that you have a long and fruitful career in the fiscal office.
Well, thank you. In a strange kind of way, I'm looking forward to this session.
It will be strange. We promise you that.
With that, may we have LFO's recommendation?
Yes. LFO, likewise, with DAS, recommends acknowledgement and receipt of the report.
Thank you.
So,
motion?
I move.
We have a motion to move the LFO recommendation to full. Is there a discussion? Objection? Without objection, the motion carries. And let's see here. Representative Boone, will you carry this one?
Sure.
Thank you very much. And we'll move ahead to item number 36, the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries.
Don't be saluting him.
Good morning, Director McConnell. Please begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Vicki McConnell, and I'm the Director of the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. I would like to, with the committee's permission, to offer the briefest of background information on our request this morning. The agency operates with a rich funding mixture of general funds appropriations, federal funds from grants and contracts, and other funds also for contracts for services and revenues from fee revenues. When we are developing our budget, it is particularly difficult to precisely calculate our other funds expenditures based on the nature of the other funds that we do use. And I wanted to give you a few examples of this 2005-2007 biennium where we are either approaching or getting very near to exceeding our other funds expenditure limitation. In our regulatory program, the Mineral Lands Regulation and Regulation Program, because it is a regulation program, we do at times have more Attorney General fees than we anticipate and that we budget in our budget. And we're finding that this biennium is one of those times when we have a bit more than what we had in the budget, and so we're looking at requesting other funds expenditure limitation increase for that. In our geologic survey and services program, we rely on a high percentage of other funds contract for services from other state agencies. And we attempt to develop memos of understanding with many of those state agencies so that we have a fairly good idea of what those expenses may be over the biennium. But many times the issues that other agencies come to us for our scientific expertise is issue driven. So we really have no way of anticipating what those contracts for services may be at the beginning of the biennium. And this particular biennium, we have a variety of other agencies that have come to us with issue-driven contract requests, and we've been happy to help them out with them, but that has caused us to approach our limitation for other funds. And finally, we operate the nature of the Northwest Information Center, which is a retail outlet for natural resource information in cooperation with the U.S. Forest Service. We sell recreation passes through that that outlet. Again, it's difficult to anticipate how recreation passes are going to sell through a biennium. This has been a pretty 2005 was a record year for recreation pass sales, and we anticipate it'll be a high sales year through the rest of 2006. My note on those recreation passes, that is really a wash for our agency. The passes are sold at our recreation center. The expenses are go back to the Forest Service. So it's really a courtesy that we offer for the people of Oregon. So based on those unanticipated costs, we are requesting an increase in our other funds limitations for expenditures for the rest of this biennium. And I'm happy to answer any questions that anyone has.
Questions or comments? Let's go to the DAS recommendation.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, my name is Lisa Pearson with the Department of Administrative Services, and we recommend that the subcommittee approve the request with the following modification, that the increase of $589,000 other funds limitation be approved with the understanding that DAS will, in fact, unschedule $561,965 until final agreements are reached. The reason for the difference between the $589,000 and the $561,000 that we would recommend unscheduling is the Attorney General costs, which we're assuming need to be paid promptly. And so that piece of it would be immediately available to the agency, and then the $561,000 would become available as the agreements were finalized.
Mr. Siebert.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, LFO is recommending an increase in the other fund expenditure limitation of $588,709. This is off slightly from what DAS has recommended, but it's the accurate total of all the additional expenditures the department is expecting to make. And likewise, we're recommending that the Department of Administrative Services unschedule $561,709, the difference being monies for the Attorney General's cost to be approved immediately.
Thank you. Discussion?
I move the LFO recommendation, Madam Chair, and if I could, for future reference, ask Mr. Seifert to read his reports more quickly.
So noted. Have the motion. Is there discussion on the motion? Is there objection to the motion? Without objection, the motion is carried. Representative Smith, could you take this one in the full? And let's move on then to item number 37. Thank you very much. Thank you.
I'll read quickly this time.
Okay, here's your chance, Mr.
Yeah, yeah. You can shine now. I'll read very, very quickly. This one's complicated.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good morning,
Director Koba. Katie Koba, Director of the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And the first item is the assistance to the fishermen because of the salmon crisis. We do have a number of members of the Coastal Caucus here in the room today, another member that serves on the committee, and I'm not sure if you wanted to have them come to the table for any reason or make a few comments.
If you do the right thing, we'll just sit.
We do very much appreciate you taking time out of your schedules to be here today, and we also appreciate the hours that you've put into this process. I think that you've made it a much better process by your actions.
Madam Chair, some of these individuals have come a long way. You are the chair manager.
Well, stop asking so many questions, you
Sir,
and Greg,
you're
and then we'll
to buy
them
a tank of gas or something?
Madam Chair, I can report that we were together late yesterday afternoon, met together as well with some members of the industry. I think it was a good discussion, and I know Representative Boone perhaps can make comments if appropriate during the course of our discussion. We are here before you this morning to request release of $500,000 from the emergency fund to the Department of Economic and Community Development. Which may seem strange that I'm sitting here making that request. However, during the first go-round of spending the Strategic Reserve $500,000 for aid to the fishermen, there were some questions about whether the Department of Agriculture had the legal authority to distribute funds of this nature. So we're asking that the money go to Economic and Community Development. They distribute the funds. However, the Department of Agriculture is the agency that moves through the process and determines the allocation to fishermen, and then we just basically send that information to Economic and Community Development Department, and they write the check. So that's why the request is written as it is. A lot has happened between the last emergency board and this emergency board when we received the first $500,000 in Strategic Reserve Fund and distributed those dollars to the industry. It was a very quick process,
And I would need to be honest with you to say that I don't think everyone in the industry is happy with the way the ultimate allocation formula came out. I think we've all learned a lot in that process. What did happen, we received over right at 340 applications. We made awards to 283 permit holders, and the average award amount was $1,764. We used an application process whereby individuals submitted applications, attached copies of receipts or invoices for expenses on infrastructure, which is where we had targeted the money to go to based on your direction. We reviewed each of those applications a minimum of two times, went through all of the expenses a minimum of two times, totaled up what we viewed were eligible expenses, and then moved through a formula process to determine final allocation. We used a review committee to work through what the allocation should be, and I would like to thank both Representative Krieger and Representative Boone for sitting on that review committee and helping us. We'd like to ask them to serve again a second time, assuming this second $500,000 is approved, but I could certainly understand if they chose to have someone else serve. That being said, we are prepared to receive a second $500,000 to distribute to the industry. We would suggest that we use a different process than what we did the first time around. And I think what we'd like to target is using as a basis for determining the allocation the landings that fishermen have had in 2003, 2004, or 2005. That was a piece of the information that we used in the first round of distribution. But what we'd like to do is pull the review committee together again, assuming approval of the second $500,000, and sit with them and determine the final allocation award for the second $500,000. With that, I think I'll pause and answer any questions that you may have.
The difference between the process in the first allocation, and I would like to interject that having taken a look at the process and touched base with you and your staff several times as that unfolded, I was very impressed with how the department put a process together that addressed the concerns that we talked about when the issue came before the emergency board. So I'm curious if you could be a little bit more specific about what didn't work in the first go-round and what you're going to do in the second go-round to help address that.
Madam Chair, I think part of the challenge was we were moving very quickly to distribute the funds. And it became apparent after the applications were submitted, and even more apparent after the dollars were allocated, that there was confusion among the industry about how the dollars would be allocated, and some people didn't realize that it was going to be so important to actually submit receipts for expenditures. And there was miscommunication in the industry, which I think was very unfortunate. That being said, we did a lot of analysis in terms of looking at the percentage of the industry that brings in the most landings, the percentage of the industry that got the amount of assistance. And we feel very comfortable that in the first go-around, the folks that are the primary fishermen of the industry did receive the largest amount of the assistance. We did skew it a little bit so that those that perhaps don't bring in as many landings got a higher amount than they would have maybe under a straight formula based on landings. But in comparing the first round to some scenarios of taking a percentage of landings, which is what we would use as our basis in the second round, we're pretty similar. So we feel very comfortable that based on all the work that we did in the first round and shifting to a process that might be easier for the industry to understand would still be targeting those that the committee really feels should get the money and targeting the kinds of expenses that are needed. But we just think we can do it in a simpler
way. So it just streamlines the process.
Exactly.
But it still has pretty much the same net effect in terms of who gets the money.
That is correct.
Okay. That's Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would like to thank Katie and her staff and all the people involved in this process, because I think we at least owe you a new set of contacts or something. I'm sure you've dried out more. All the hours of work that they did and the tedious work. And the Coastal Caucus input, everybody came together. Yesterday's meeting was very good with members of the industry there, and they understand that. And with the anticipation of receiving the second round of funding, I think they're very comfortable with the fact of how we plan to go forward with it. And I will gladly serve on the committee again with my buddy Wayne, if you will. And I want to just thank everybody for coming together. It was a fast process, and I think it just was, it kind of was a little mind-blowing how state government could work so fast. But the biggest piece of this, too, is hoping, and we did get a disaster designation by the federal government. We didn't get the same kind we'd really have liked to, because without us, and it's different kinds of designations, some will allow federal unemployment benefits to kick in, whereas some of these boat owners don't get them because they are not employees. In that sense, they're employees. We're not covered by this funding because they could get unemployment from the way they do it. But anyway, that didn't happen, and so I know some of the people might have been disappointed because of that, so they didn't submit for this round. We may see those people submitting for this round or the first round. They might try the second round. Mm-hmm. And I do hold out hope, after talking with Scott Bowley last night after our meeting, that the federal delegation is working hard on this and will come up with some money from them to help us through this problem. And having learned all the lessons we learned in the timber crisis, you know, the same thing, hopefully some of these natural disasters that happen, that we can help them with these.
Director Colbert, do you know the dimensions of the federal, what the federal designation will bring to the fleet?
Madam Chair, I'm certainly not fully up to speed on that. I have heard some estimates that have been given to our congressional delegation from the Oregon industry in terms of need of aid, $30 million roughly, I think. So I know that the congressional...
In the form of loans?
Under the first emergency declaration made by the feds, that did trigger loan availability. I think everyone has pretty much made it clear that when you don't have any money, it doesn't make sense to go after a loan, especially given the uncertainty of the future of the fishery, at least for the next few years. So I think there is a pretty strong desire to go after grant kind of support from the feds.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Morgan. Talk about how you assisted those most in need versus those who just made application and submitted reimbursement.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I think it's an oversimplification to say that it was a challenging process to try to go through that and determine most in need. What we ended up doing is receiving the applications, as I indicated, and going through, and first of all, they had to have landings in 03, 04, or 05 in Oregon to qualify. And then we were able to compare landings in 06, and anyone who had landings in 06 higher than the highest landings in the previous 3 years did not qualify. Obviously, we had asked for receipts or invoices in terms of eligible expenditures targeting infrastructure, so we totaled those up. In some cases, we had situations where landings, the expenses submitted were higher than landing values in 03, 04, 05, and in that case, the maximum figure that we were targeting would have been the landings value as opposed to a higher expenses value, so they could not receive money greater than what they had in landings. And then each of the applications had a section in terms of where they would spell out statement of need. And as I said, we read through each of those applications a minimum of 2 times. And in reading through those statements, which there was a variety, obviously, as you can well imagine, it became clear to all of us that there was great need on the coast because of the closure. And we came to the point where we realized there was no way that we could just determine an allocation on need. The need was there. The need was greater than the $500,000 that we had. So we went back to a formula based on landings value, percentage of income that came from salmon fishing versus other fisheries or other employment. And if you had salmon income higher than 50%, 50% or greater than your total income, then we weighted that applicant. If your salmon income was less than 50% of your total income, then you received a smaller percentage of expense reimbursement, and it just became a formula allocation based on the information.
Does the next $500,000 meet their needs in the entirety?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, not even close.
So then what do we do after that $500,000?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I think the focus really then turns on the federal assistance program and that the industry and the congressional delegation working together to target federal assistance.
Again, my heart goes out to these folks. I've been through this in a different industry. I know I'm going to be viewed as non-compassionate. Please don't take it that way. This is great politics, but again, this isn't assisting. We're putting a Band-Aid on a significant wound in an industry, and I'm not sure what $1 million does. I mean, if you want to help this industry, if you want to help the coast, we need to get those boats out in the water and let them fish. Thank you.
Representative,
I can try to address what Greg just said, and Representative Smith, excuse me, and that is that the purpose of this was to hold it together, hold the infrastructure together as a in a timely manner. Hopefully, that the federal government would have come forward as quickly. We know they don't work quite as quickly as the state does, but keeping in mind that there are a lot of different levels of need and all that, but the main one was holding on to the boat, the permit, the ability to get out and fish as soon as possible. And we're holding out great hope for our federal friends.
Madam Chair, I do want to add just for the record, the review committee had a spreadsheet of information available to them as they were determining an allocation formula. But in the course of that, we did not have the name of the individual or the boat name in that review. So we were, again, trying to keep the process as objective as we possibly could.
And again, from my understanding and watching the process, I was very impressed with the way that the department handled it. Any further questions for the director? Let's have DAS's recommendation.
Madam Chair, Lisa Pearson with DAS. The department recommends the subcommittee approve the request.
And Mr. Seaborn on behalf of LFO.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, LFO is recommending allocation of $500,000 from the reservation in the emergency fund to the Oregon Economic Community Development Department with funding determinations to be made by Department of Ag, and would just stress again that the department use a formula based on need to address the need of the fishermen rather than an even split among all fishermen as you've heard that they are proposing to do.
Madam Chair, I was very pleased earlier when we had conversation around the fisheries issues, and I'm just as pleased today, and will ask that we accept the report based upon DAS and LFO.
I have a motion to move the LFO recommendation to full with a due pass. Is there discussion on the motion? Objection? Without objection, the motion carries, and I will carry this one in full. And with that closing, we will move on to canola research.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, Katie Kova, Director of the Department of Agriculture. I fear this issue has become as controversial as the salmon assistance program. With me is Russ Caro from Oregon State University, and he is the lead staff person from Oregon State on the proposed research proposal. So he's available to answer questions as well. What we are requesting is $235,000 in emergency fund dollars to the Department of Agriculture We would then contract with Oregon State University to conduct multi-pronged research around the issue of canola and potential alternatives to canola as a source for biodiesel in Oregon. This issue really became on our radar screen about a year ago with the growing interest in biodiesel in Oregon and the fact that canola is currently the most productive feedstock source for biodiesel production. The problem with canola is that it comes from a brassica family, which includes other crops such as cauliflower, broccoli, etc. And in the Willamette Valley in Oregon, as well as in central Oregon and a stretch along the Idaho border in Malheur County, there is a lot of specialty seed production, producers that grow seed for sale then to various entities to grow crops, as well as vegetable production. And the concern among specialty seed and vegetable producers is producing canola in proximity to these other crops can lead to problems with diseases, pests, as well as canola is a very aggressive crop and it can spread. The seeds are very, very small and it can spread along ditch rows and become, in essence, kind of a weed, which would be a bad thing for our specialty seed and vegetable producers. So with the push around biodiesel, the specialty seed industry started expressing their concerns and came to the department and asked us to set up control districts within the state whereby specialty seed and vegetable production would be protected. We did that through rule last summer, and the protected areas include the Willamette Valley, the three counties in central Oregon, Deschutes, Crook and Jefferson, a strip along the Idaho border, and then a small area in northeast Oregon where there is specialty seed production. And in order to produce canola in these areas, individuals have to come to the department and request a special permit and identify what they would grow, what their control measures would be in place, how far away from specialty seed or vegetable production their production would be. We received our first special permit request last February, and I think it was a surprise to all of us that it actually came in so quickly. And it certainly is a reflection, I believe, on the increasing diesel prices and the impact that has on producers in the state. The permit was actually a request to grow 100 acres of canola in the South Willamette Valley. This individual intended to build his own crusher on farm. He would harvest the canola, crush it on farm, and use it in on farm as diesel for his own production equipment, so it wasn't to move into a commercial chain. Our rules indicate that we need to bring together a group of individuals to review the permit request. We did that. And in the course of that review, we determined to not approve the special permit. However, given the list of questions out there and the fact that we felt we didn't have good answers, what did come out of that review committee was a recommendation to move forward with some research with Oregon State University to address the issue of whether canola could be grown in the valley or in central Oregon or in these protected districts. If so, how it should be grown, what would be isolation distances from other specialty seed and vegetable crops, what kind of monitoring and cleanup requirements would be in place. Secondly, are there alternatives to canola that could be produced in the valley or in these other areas that could be developed as a viable feedstock for biodiesel, and what would those be? And then thirdly, develop a GIS mapping system of soil types and where specialty seed and vegetable production occur in the state. Right now, the way this is done is through extension offices. There's a big map on the board. If someone is growing a specialty seed crop, they go in and they do what's called pinning, and they stick a pin in the board. And that is how we know where these crops are grown, and we really need to take advantage of our technology and get that on a mapping system so we know better where that's happening. When the pin falls out, you know, that's a problem. So the research request for $235,000, we would begin research immediately on some field trials of canola production in the valley. OSU has identified five sites Four of those sites are 20 acres. One is a 24-acre plot. And I do have a map of those if the committee is interested in seeing those plots. Go ahead and distribute those. Secondly, to commence research on alternatives to canola, and the planting for those trials would occur this winter and into the spring. And then thirdly, begin the GIS mapping system. Based on results from the field trials of canola, OSU would update what they call an enterprise budget, which is really taking what are the kinds of yields that we're seeing in a more field-type planting regimen, and are those yields viable in terms of being an economic opportunity for producers in the valley. So with that, I think I will pause. This is, as I said, controversial. The specialty seed producers have concerns about moving forward with the field trials. Again, we feel this is the best way to do it, with close OSU monitoring of the trials to really find out what happens when we plant canola, and if it is even an option to have canola production in the valley or in these other protected districts. So our goal is to find answers to the many questions that are out there.
Thank you. I think that over the last week or so, I've learned more about canola and specialty seed crops than I ever had any idea was out there to learn. And I'm sure there's still a bunch of stuff that I don't know. But some questions did come forward. And so I'm very glad that you're here today, because I am real interested in the mechanics of the proposed study. And the concerns that have been addressed to me are that there is questions about how much of the study money is going to be focused on canola, how much is focused on the other seed crops that will be looked at as alternatives to canola, and then how much goes into the GIS mapping piece of the thing. Just, I think that there are questions around how much of the study is going to be on the alternative seed crops, which is, I think, where most people are interested in. The other point that of concern that's been expressed to me is the measures that are going to be in place to guarantee, if you will, that the trials, the canola trials, won't interfere with the specialty seed crops. And there have been many issues raised, as Katie brought forward, around the contamination and the diseases. And so if you could just, in your discussion about the shape of the research project, if you could help answer those questions, that would be very helpful to me.
Madam Chair, if we start with the map that you have.
For the record, please.
My name is Russ Carroll. I'm head of the Department of Crop and Soil Science at Oregon State University.
Thank you.
In choosing the field sites for the trials, we've specifically chosen sites that are farther apart than is in specialty seed channels these days. You need to have a minimum of a 3-mile distance. Any of the sites that we have at this point are 5 miles or greater from current or known plantings of specialty seeds. So we've tried to locate sites that should cause minimum interference with any specialty seed production. They're all located in fields that have not been in brassica production previously. The fields are coming out of grass seed. They will be in the canola trials for a single year, and then be planted back to grass or grains. So as far as some of the disease buildup, some of the insect concerns that people would have in just looking at the research trials themselves, we should minimize any potential risk, especially of disease buildup. The insects are an unknown in this whole process, and I can touch on that again. One of the issues is containment of the seed itself. What we plan to do is to work with the grower cooperators. We will either harvest into bags, they're 1-ton tote bags that are self-contained, or into sealed trucks. and we will clean combines. We've got people set up to work with the growers to clean the combines before they move from the field. If they use swathing equipment, to make sure that it's clean before they leave the fields. So as best as is possible, we will contain the seed to the research sites. Insects are an unknown. The insect that is of greatest concern is a cabbage maggot. Cabbage maggot is found throughout the Willamette Valley. We have very large populations of wild brassica species on which the cabbage maggot can grow. In talking with talked with two different individuals who are entomologists at Oregon State University. Dr. Glenn Fisher has 30 years of experience in the state working with vegetable and other crops. His response in being asked the question if we would cause additional problems by putting out these research plots was that the background levels of cabbage maggot were high enough that there wouldn't be any long-term effect from these plots themselves. Very different issue from larger scale canola production. The other individual that I talked to is Dr. Amy Dreeves. She's done some modeling work with the cabbage maggot and has indicated that indeed with fields as large as we are have proposed, the 20 to 24 acre, and the timing of that particular crop, because it's the canola is an early flowering crop, that we're very likely to draw insects to the fields. But what the long-term effect of that will be, especially since we're 5 or more miles from other production, is unknown at this point, and that's part of what we would be able to do with these trials.
Senator.
Thank you. Doctor, if I were a farmer in Yamhill, Washington, of Clackamas, why would I fear such a pilot program? Why, just if you just use a little conjecture at this point.
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, our perception is that we should not fear the small plots. The real question is if we were to move to larger scale canola production with less control, then there are possibilities for seed scatter is probably the greatest problem that we face, and potentially cross pollination between some of the specialty seed crops and volunteer canola. But again, in the cross-pollination issue is oftentimes the one that's first brought up, but it may be the least of the concerns because of the synchrony of when the different crops are actually flowering. But again, that's something that we need to go out and look at this point. But as far as the research plots themselves, we see very little risk at this point as far as long-term impacts.
So with reference to the pollination issue, that was another question that I have no information on and I was wanting to ask about too. From the perspective of the proposed test plots, what is the danger of pollination from those test plots impacting the specialty seed growers? Is it zero or?
Madam Chair, with biological agents, you can never say zero,
okay.
But it is minimal. So the current standard for specialty seeds is a 3-mile isolation distance between fields, and so the pinning that Director Koba had mentioned, growers actually go in and pin fields on a map so that they are at least 3 miles from other production fields. And as I'd indicated earlier, these particular sites are 5 miles from any known production at this point.
So if you have a 3-mile buffer, are there instances in tests that you've done previously in other species where there has been cross-pollination issues across that 3-mile level?
We've not done work specifically with canola. The evidence that we're looking at comes from other parts of the world, Canada and Europe.
No, not just canola. I mean, I'm talking just in general. When you put a test plot on the ground and you put a 3-mile buffer around it, have there been instances in the history of this form of experimentation where there has been cross-pollination across that 3-mile buffer?
Chair, yes. In the case of canola, you're working with honeybees, or there are insect pollinators, and so if those insect pollinators are out foraging for other sources of nectar, they can move beyond a 3-mile distance. But what they found in the industry is that level, that 3-mile distance, in work done with other crops are different in that many are wind pollinated, and so you have a whole different dynamic if you've got a crop that's wind pollinated versus one that's can be insect pollinated.
And canola is insect pollinated?
Really? Yes. The yellow flowers are very attractive to insects, and it is insect pollinated. There can be self-pollination as well. But we're likely that time of year to draw insects to the fields.
So the 5-mile buffer, how does that, are the bees still, is it still possible for the bees to fly that far?
Madam Chair, you're stepping beyond my area of knowledge, but yes, it's from the bits and pieces that I know, bees can move that kind of a distance.
And the disease issues, are those the same? Is the disease spread in the same way by the bees and by birds eating the seeds?
Madam Chair, no. The diseases tend to be isolated to the field, and where you run into problems is repeated growth of a susceptible crop in that field over time. There are very specific restrictions in canola production in general on how often you can plant back to a given field to try to avoid disease problems. There are requirements for seed treatments to be used in order to avoid disease. But some of the diseases that we're working with are fairly ubiquitous, and this is a problem as well. There's a disease called sclerotinia. That is common in canola, is also found in some of the clovers. But again, it's a disease that would move with tillage equipment. There are sclerotia that are found in the soil. So it would be movement of soil predominantly that would transfer it from one field to the other.
So from the point of view of the trial plots, it wouldn't be an issue?
Yeah, it should be. They should be contained in those sites. And a disease like sclerotinia is everywhere. It's a matter of building it up in the soil by growing crops that are susceptible. And the grass and grain crops that we would grow, that have been grown in these fields and will be grown in these fields, are not susceptible to FOMA, to clubroot, to sclerotinia, which are the diseases of major concern to the specialty seed growers.
But let me go back just for a minute to the pollination issue with the bees, because I want to try to quantify what the risk is there. So if you had to put, and I know this is going to put you on the spot, so forgive me for this, but I'm really trying to understand what the relative risks are. Is it possible for you to say, to put some kind of a percentage on what you think the probability is that there will be a pollination issue with bees into the specialty seed growers' crops?
Madam Chair, the specialty seed growers themselves have established the 3-mile isolation distance and used that for decades as a distance that's acceptable, and they have been successful in growing crops. They will go out in rogue wild plants, feral plants around fields and road banks and ditches to remove them as potential sources of pollen for their fields, but the three-mile distance is something that's readily accepted in the industry at this point.
So by almost doubling that, then, it just adds that much more of a level of protection.
Correct.
To the... Okay, that helps me understand it. Representative...
Madam Chair, I would concur with that. I used to keep bees, and just as when my children told me they were going to the library to study, I assumed that that's where they were, and my bees were never allowed to go farther than 3 miles from the hive. And I know that for a fact.
Doctor, one other question. Have you participated in any other projects of this nature where you were planting something that could have been of concern to farmers?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, the members of our faculty in crop and soil science were involved in the bent grass control district in Central Oregon, and Dr. Carol Mallory Smith is the lead of our weed management program in the department, and she has been actively engaged in monitoring the situation in Central Oregon with the escape of seed from the control district.
Were there concerns, Madam Chair? Were there concerns by other farmers that this would be a problem or create a problem?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, yes, there were, and that was the very reason for establishing the control district. And Director Kobar, others may be able to better address that than myself.
And your findings, Madam Chair, your findings of the fears that people had were nullified, or as a result, or no cross-pollination took place, or... No, I mean, you're talking to Kobe, huh?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Carter, it is a bit of a different situation. We
okay.
specifically identified the control district where the field trial could be planted in Central Oregon in order to protect the valley grass seed industry.
Okay.
And so that was, 100 miles away. The seed escape from the field trial has been documented, I think, up to a distance of 12 to 13 miles outside of the control district, if I remember correctly. Grass seed is wind-pollinated. We had a windstorm that came up right before harvest, and seed blew everywhere. What's happening is this was a trial to convince the federal government to deregulate the seed, so it's a different situation than what we're in now, and the feds are going through an environmental impact statement in order to make a determination whether they would deregulate the grass seed or not. So it's a little different than this. The grass seed growers were concerned but felt with the control district that far away from the Willamette Valley that it would be adequate.
I'm not sure my line of questioning has everything to do with the fact of questions that you had asked before, number one, and number two was designed to show that there's enough distance between where this is that if a person lived in Washington or Clackamas, they would have to have the kind of concerns or fears about the traveling of these of any kind of disease factors that you may find over here.
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, I think just to echo what Russ had indicated, I think the bigger concern from the specialty seed industry that this is the first step and a step to having widespread canola production in the valley, and that's what they don't want. We don't know if you can do it in the valley or not, or if you can do it in a limited manner in the valley with some protective measures in place. That's why we're proposing the research to help us find some answers to these questions, because the question will continue to be raised, particularly if diesel prices stay at the level that they're at. There are people that want to grow canola on their farmland in the valley.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Morgan. Is this an emergency that constitutes emergency board action?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I knew we were going to get to that. That's been raised in the LFO recommendation, which we clearly understand and respect. From our standpoint, the issue is the canola is a fall planting. and we are ready to go with planting this fall. If we don't, then we're a year delayed. And all that means is we're a year farther behind in terms of having some answers to questions. And frankly, if we see another year next year like we did this year, I think there are going to be some producers who are not willing to wait a year before they can plant canola on their property in the valley. So what we're really trying to do is get a jump on anticipating the increasing pressure that's going to come around this issue and have some objective information by which we can make a decision. Otherwise, I'm afraid I'm going to be faced with making a decision without having the information that I need to do so.
No disagreement. Is this an emergency?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, from my perspective, yes, it is.
I want to come back to the description of the research project itself. I think that you've described to us the mechanics of the canola plots. Can you talk to us about what the questions are that you're going to get a start on answering after the project is finished? I mean, what are we going to know when you've done, if you get to do this work, when the outcomes are known?
And before Russ takes that, I should clarify for the committee, this is an ongoing research project. We do have included in our agency request funding to continue the research for at least an additional 2 years. So this is not a one-year research project and done. It is going to be a multi-year research project, which is another issue that the LFO staff raised in terms of if you commit to this year and then it's not approved in our budget, are you wasting resources? But given that,
so
Madam
what
Chair,
we find out what questions are going to be answered relating to canola growing in the valley.
What we intend to do in the research, we'll have a very unique situation creating these large blocks of plants in areas where we have no other planted fields of canola. So we have a research team. From one thing is we found at this point that there's very little difference among varieties, but there are differences in fertility, the effect of nitrogen fertilizer on plant growth. So in these large fields, we'll be establishing sub-trials to look at nitrogen fertility to try to maximize yields so that we can look at the yield component. So the yield component and just the economics, we've got a group from the Department of Ag Resource and Economics on campus who will be working with us to look at just the economics of production itself.
So theoretically, we should be able then to figure out whether the valley or what the capacity is for canola production in the valley relative to the needs of a commercial level biodiesel refinery. Would that be one practical application of the information?
Madam Chair, I think what I would say at this point is we can't grow enough canola in the state of Oregon to meet the needs of a commercial plant.
Exactly. And right.
So what we're looking at in this scenario is the situation where there is interest in smaller plants than the 20, 30 million gallon plants that have been proposed. We're actually, if we were to look at it, we have other oilseed industries in the state of Oregon that are growing, things like Meadowfoam in the Willamette Valley. The problem with Meadowfoam at this point is that they're having to move their crop to California, previously to Texas, to be crushed. If we were to put a small crushing plant in the Willamette Valley in cooperation with groups like the Meadowfoam growers, what that group would need, and that would be a much smaller plant, something that's on the order of a ton or two a day of crush versus the mega volumes that are found in commercial plants. But you'd need a crop to floor. You're not going to have enough Meadowfoam likely to run a plant like that on an ongoing basis. But if you had small acreage production of something like canola that has an open market, you could crush in that kind of a plant. The other thing that we've looked at, there are much higher values in oil seeds than biodiesel is the bottom of the barrel. Pendleton Grain Growers is, there are two small crushing plants in the state at this point, and Pendleton Grain Growers is one of those, and they're actually looking at the essentially extra virgin canola oil for salad markets, mustard-based markets, and whereas the canola oil for biodiesel has a value of 30 cents a pound, the raw vegetable oils in that other kind of use can be as much as $3 or more a pound. So if we're looking at canola production in the state, biodiesel is probably, other than for an on-farm use or the small-scale use that I mentioned, to think about us as a commercial biodiesel producer is from being able to grow the crop to feed a large-scale plant is probably not going to happen. But there would be huge benefit from a rotation standpoint. What growers face here in the Willamette Valley is we've had over the last decade a buildup of grassy weed species in some of the grass seed crops due to changes in production practices, the lack of field burning, the move towards more conservation tillage plantings, and growers are in desperate need in some cases of rotational crops and a broadleaf crop in which you could get very good control of the grassy weeds in particular, and a grass volunteer would be extremely valuable. So as you look at, other than the value of the canola itself, that rotation benefit could potentially be quite valuable to growers.
Can we move on now to the research around the other seed plant or the oil seeds that are talked about in the proposal? And can you talk to us about what the shape of that is and what you're hoping to be able to find out with those trials?
Chair, well, the plan at this point is to look at, we've done some work with other oil seed crops here in the valley. There are none that have the same yield potential or oil percentage as canola, so canola is by far the best fit. But other crops that fit our production environment would include winter flax, a crop that we have historically grown in the state of Oregon. Flax could be cold-pressed, crushed, similar to canola, to yield oil that could be used in biodiesel or in other industrial or food uses. We intend to look at yellow mustard, which is it's a different species than the brassicas, so it's not cross-compatible with the brassica crops. It still may have some of the same disease and insect issues, but to a lesser extent than canola. There's a crop called camelina that's a very new crop that's being looked at across the western United States. Short-seasoned, low-water requiring crop. It's spring-planted, but it may be successful in a Willamette Valley non-irrigated environment. And then the other crop we intend to look at is safflower. We've done some work with safflower decades ago at the university, and it again is one that we know will grow in this environment that has pesticide labels and things for it, established markets both for industrial and food uses. And again, it would be totally different, would not carry the same diseases or insect problems that the canola would have. But the minute we move away from a winter annual plant, all the safflower, the camelina, the yellow mustard are spring crops, and we're moving out of synchrony with the production capability of our dryland environments in Oregon.
So the outcome then for the other seed crops would be to try to ascertain the economic viability of those crops in the different regions that you test them in?
Correct. What growers who are interested in the rotational crops and in their own on-farm production of biodiesel have told us is that they could be successful in those endeavors with significantly lower yields.
Okay.
And so that's where we're thinking that these other crops may still have a place, is that if they're truly after the rotational benefit and can make a biodiesel, on-farm biodiesel operation functional at a lower yield level, that those are the ones that have possibilities.
And then the mapping part of this, that I think Katie did a good job of outlining what that is all about. Is the mapping technology already existing technology at OSU or within the Department of Ag? Are you just, or do you have to create new technology to do this?
Madam Chair, I didn't bring the specific website reference, but I would encourage members of the committee to go to the OSU site and do a search on PRISM, P-R-I-S-M. There is a group in the College of Oceanic and Atmospheric Sciences who are national and international leaders in doing geoclimatic mapping, and they have, because of funding sources, done entire maps for the country of China, but we don't have maps of the state of Oregon with the group based here because the funding has not been available to do the work. So as part of this proposal, we have $50,000 that would go to Chris Daly, Dr. Chris Daly, and the PRISM mapping group to do initial geoclimatic maps for Western Oregon. And we see that the advantage there is that once we have those maps in place, where it will be very useful for canola, where we can look at, we know that canola, for example, does not do well on poorly drained soils. So we can look at these 3 and 5 mile isolation distances. We can look at soil types and pull those things together through GIS technology to look at areas of the valley where we may be able to produce canola with other controls in place as well. But having those maps in place will allow us to answer many other questions. So if we find that camelina or some other crop seems to have a fit in the valley, if we know the growth parameters of that crop, we can do some simple mapping to see where it would fit best.
So you just lay down a soil types layer and a rainfall layer and just see what matches up with it?
Madam Chair, they do soils, high, low temperature, average temperatures. We can look at wind patterns if we have the data from weather sites. So there's been, with insects, direction of wind and wind flows is an issue, and you can look at that with these kind of mapping techniques. And it will allow us to answer additional, once we have it in place again, global warming is an issue, and you may have read about some of the concern about movement of grape production if you get slight changes in temperature. With this kind of a platform in place, you could do what-if kinds of questions of that type as well. So it has much broader applicability than we're immediately addressing the canola issue, but then can expand beyond to other crops and other scenarios in agriculture.
So 50,000 of the 235,000 is allocated for the mapping project. How much of it, can you give us the breakout on the allocation for the canola part of the thing and then the other species piece?
Some of those are hard to, Madam Chair, to separate out. What our intent is we have a half-time faculty research assistant who will be slated to lead the field trialed efforts. So that individual would do both work with county faculty members to do the field trials with growers and then also do the smaller scale alternate crop studies. So there's one individual there with some student labor and services and supplies, so that budget is roughly $60,000. To look at the issues, another part of the budget is for a graduate research assistant to work with Dr. Carol Mallory Smith to look at the pollination issues. She's done work previously in other crops, and she'll be working with Dr. Jim Myers in horticulture to look at pollen movement from the fields. And they'll also be monitoring the fields subsequent to this crop year for the seed bank that's been established by having grown the canola crop, and then what the level of volunteer is in those fields in over time. So they'll do very specific studies on that.
So the fields that you're going to do the canola tests in and the fields that you're testing the other seed crops, are they in the same areas? Are they all part of the same identified plots?
Madam Chair, the intent is, because these are winter-planted, non-irrigated fields, we will put small drill strips of winter flax in these same fields, but then the other crops will be tested at Hislop Farm, our major research site, and possibly another site. But as they are spring-planted, we're talking about different production conditions and perhaps the need for irrigation depending on what next spring is like, and so to try to manage those kinds of spring midwinter spring planted crops in these field locations would be difficult.
And so the GRA is going to be working again on all on both the canola piece and the alternate piece.
Right, correct.
Okay, and how much have you allocated for that position?
For what we're calling the canola concerns, literature review, pollen studies, there's roughly $35,000. And then there's also a graduate research assistant who will be involved with the project out of the Ag Research and Economics Department. So those are the individuals that will look at the enterprise budget sheets that Director Koba mentioned, who will look at the bigger, there is interest in the canola not only for the oil but for the meal. So one of our cooperators, Larry Vanell, has a pelletizing feed operation. He's having to import canola rapeseed meal at this point for part of his feed operation. So there's another dynamic there to look at, is to see not only what can be done on farm, but if you had a very small localized feed industry, what are the economic possibilities for that as well. And so the AREC graduate students will be looking at both these on-farm, local, and distant transport kind of issues with the canola, and then looking at the economics of the other crops as well.
They're essentially number crunching to find out whether this is a viable economic undertaking.
Correct.
Okay. And how much have you got in that one?
$26,000.
Okay. And are those the components of the project right there? That's the whole thing of it? Yeah.
There's okay. another $10,000 for web development.
Okay.
So we've got a group that will deliver information on an ongoing basis through a joint ODA-OSU webpage.
I think I've gotten all the answers to my questions. Does anybody else want to make any comments, questions, or anything? Okay, let's get LFO or DAS's recommendation.
I'm Charlie, the person with DAS. DAS recommends that we approve the request.
And LFO's recommendation.
Madam Chair, Legislative Fiscal Office is recommending denial of the request for a number of reasons. If it's the pleasure of the Chair, we can methodically work through each of those reasons for Senator Westland's benefit. Otherwise, we would just leave it at that we are recommending denial of the request.
Okay. Colleagues, this is, I think, a special and verily gnarly issue that has been brought before us. As is often the case in natural resource issues, we have a very highly polarized public in the ag community around this. We have, obviously, a lot of people that are very interested in exploring the alternate fuels aspects of this, and a lot of questions that are unanswered about what the potential impacts of this are. The I recognize LFO's concerns on the fiscal side of this, in that we have got a lot of requests against the money that we have left in the E-Fund. But I do think that in terms of the ag community, particularly the folks in the grass seed end of the thing that are actively looking for other crops right now, that this research is important for the state to undertake. And so with that, I would like to have a discussion around how the committee feels about moving this to the full committee with a recommendation that we fund it.
Madam Chair, I move the DAS recommendation.
I'm not going to take the motion because I want to hear what the other committee members think before we do that.
Madam Chair, my position would be that we're never going to get on the top side of research unless we start at one point or another. I cook with canola oil, so I'm...
Well, declare a conflict.
He told me to declare a conflict.
So you're okay with moving the DAS recommendation?
Yes.
Representative Smith, how do you feel about this?
Well, I'm a little indifferent, to be candid. But I guess I want to look at the opportunity cost we as legislators have to face. How much remaining e-board money do we have?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, that really depends on what happens tomorrow. I know that based on the LFO recommendations to the requests, we have recommended that all the money would not be spent that's available. But if all the requests were approved as forwarded, there would be not enough money in the emergency fund. I think that we've taken steps to ensure that that won't happen. I don't believe that's likely to happen, even if you do approve this, because there's a large request, for example, for the Public Defense Services Commission that I think we're recommending only half the money be approved. Additionally, there should be some funds available at the next emergency board that aren't available now, some special appropriation money that you cannot access at this point but should be able to at the next emergency board. So I think it would be within your capacity to approve this request at this point.
Yeah, I guess my take on it, Madam Chair, is the director stated she would contend this is an emergency. I'm assuming that she's thought through that in terms of the overall opportunity cost to the entire state of Oregon. It sounds like you've thought through this and you see a need for this. I'm indifferent. I'm willing to go where you want to go, Chair. I personally am not sure there's an emergency, but the director stated there is. So I guess I'm willing to go where you need to go.
Thank you. Representative Boone, how do you feel about this?
I agree with the proposal. I think that we have to move on it in order to not fall back the year, for one thing. But what you said is there's a growing interest in alternative crops. I mean, I have a little wheat farm in North Dakota. We're starting to grow canola, and just for that very reason, because the ducks kind of took over a lot of it. So that's another story. Not those ducks.
Yeah. How many touchdowns are the beavers?
So I will take Senator Westland's motion to move the DAS recommendation, but I would like to add to that that the department and DAS and LFO look at whether we need to, whether we should unschedule some of the money pending the rollout of this, or whether that needs to be an aspect of the discussion. So I'm hoping that you can do that. Otherwise, is there any further discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? Then, without objection, the motion is carried, and I will take this one in full. Thank you, Senator Westland. And thank you for that. And that moves us down to the Wallowa County issue.
Madam Chair, thank you. Katie Kopa, Director of the Department of Agriculture. Before you is a request for an increase in federal funds expenditure limitation of $700,000 in order for the department to receive a federal grant and pass that grant through to the Nature Conservancy for purchase of property in Wallowa County that contains a threatened and endangered plant species, Spalding's catchfly. And I believe that there is an agreement on how to handle this, so I'll just pause there unless people have questions. questions.
Is this a recommendation?
Madam Chair, Lisa Pearson with DAS, and DAS's recommendation has been that the subcommittee approve the request to increase the expenditure limitation by $700,000, but that it would be unscheduled until the federal government had provided the final approval of its grant money coming to the state. I believe that there's been something else agreed upon, and I suspect that we would be amenable to that.
Mr. Siebert.
Madam Chair, as stated in the analysis, LFO is prepared to make a recommendation at the table. And based on the fact that having conversation with someone back in D.C. just yesterday, the federal government has still not made the funds available for the grants or awarded any of the grants. Therefore, we're recommending that this request be deferred until the next meeting of the emergency board, at which time, hopefully, there will be a decision made by the federal granting authority.
Questions or comments? Representative Smith?
Thank you. I'm going to need a minute.
What's that?
I'm going to need a moment for my comments.
Okay.
And questions, actually. Colleagues, this is in the heart of my district in Wallowa County, and I guess I'd like to ask a few questions just to get them on the record and then state a few thoughts to get on the record. Let me start with my questions. Has the Department of Agriculture talked with the County Commission to gain their support of this project?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, the Department of Agriculture is just a vehicle in terms of the receiving agency for the federal funds to pass through the Nature Conservancy, and the Nature Conservancy has been the one in communication with all the interested parties.
How come the Oregon Department of Agriculture chose to accept this responsibility?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, by law, we are an eligible entity to receive the funds.
Let me re-ask my question. How come you chose to accept the responsibility?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, by law, we are an eligible entity to receive the funds.
I'm not going to get an answer to that question, am I?
Respectfully, Representative Smith, I think that the agency is bound to obey the law.
To accept a request on behalf of a nonprofit group to submit an application on their behalf? You're bound by the law to do that?
There are limited agencies within state government that have the ability to accept the funds. We have the Threatened and Endangered Plant Program within our agency, and we are responsible for monitoring and managing threatened and endangered plant species. And therefore, we are the likely agency to receive federal funds in order to protect an endangered plant.
Are you obligated to accept the application?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I'm not sure I understand your questioning.
Well, I'm trying to figure out how the Oregon Department of Agriculture decided that they would accept an application on behalf of the Nature Conservancy to make application to the federal government.
Chair, Representative Smith, we were asked to do so.
Did the department review the application? I'm trying to figure out how the state of Oregon, from the executive branch, decided that this was in the best interest of Wallowa County, Northeast Oregon, and the state of Oregon.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, again, we are a vehicle by which the money is passed through to the Nature Conservancy. We have left all of those discussions up to the Nature Conservancy and the local players. We have
What's
not been
your thought on it?
We have not been involved in the discussions.
What's your thought on
I
this?
I have no opinion on that.
What do I go home and tell the citizens of Wallowa County that our director from the Oregon Department of Ag has no opinion on this, even though it's being funded through her agency? As a tool, her agency is being used as a tool to make application?
The way we view it.
Representative Smith, I think the culprit here is the legislature. Why did we decide to accept it as a legislative entity? Wouldn't you think?
Well, it's being brought forward. I assume there was some level of review by the Oregon Department of Ag. Can you tell us about the review that went on the application?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, we review it completely for legal, for its fit within the parameters of the law, and that's what we review it for.
Your opinion as director of the agency, is there a higher and better use for this property than what is being proposed by the Nature Conservancy?
Chair Representative Smith, I am not familiar with the property.
I'm not going to get anywhere on this. Well, what I'd share with you colleagues is the citizens of Wallowa County feel as if the state of Oregon is presenting something to them or pushing something upon them that is not desired nor wanted. It's interesting that this application is being presented as an opportunity to preserve pristine land. What's not being shared is that this land is currently being used for grazing. And the reason it's pristine is because the landowner who does graze cattle on it has kept it pristine, just like many other parcels of property throughout eastern Oregon. I'm disappointed. I'm very disappointed on behalf of the leadership in our house, in the house, that this is before us today. This has nothing to do with you, Madam Director, before the house. This was not to be on here. This issue is not supposed to be coming back up in November. And when I leave here in about 30 minutes, I'm going to further that discussion. Because I'll tell you what, the folks in Northeast Oregon deserve better than this. We've allocated $1 million for fishermen on the coast, and yet we're going to help put an industry out of business in Northeast Oregon. This makes no sense. And so, in the interest of complete transparency, my comments at the last emergency board were part of an agreement to help Diamond Lake move forward. That project has moved forward. This project's not supposed to be here. It is. And that's not the way this was supposed to be. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Siebert, your recommendation is that we will defer discussion on this topic until the next e-board meeting.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Do I have a motion to move the LFO recommendation to full?
But can I just ask one question?
Yes.
Madam Director, how would this impact what you do as an agency for anybody, as long as you're doing that law? Would it affect to the negativeness of what this you plan to do with these dollars, or by waiting until December, what would be the effect?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, my understanding from the Nature Conservancy is they had an offer on the property and they were concerned that the property would not be available in November. However, apparently they are comfortable with deferring this issue until November, so they must have some plan in terms of dealing with that potential.
I'm sure I'm moving the offer. LFO's recommendation. Thank you.
And I think that also the point needs to be made that there is a letter that was sent to legislative leadership by the Wallowa County Commissioners that outlines concerns that they have, and it also states that they're working with the Nature Conservancy to mitigate those concerns. So I think that if this is brought forward in the November e-board, that is an item that we can discuss.
Yes. Madam Chair, as a point of clarification, I've had extensive conversations with the commission from Wallowa County, and their position is they do not support the use of public dollars for the acquisition of this property.
I think also you are aware that the Nature Conservancy has withdrawn its application from OWEB for that portion of the funding. And now the federal dollars that we're talking about here that pass through the Department of Ag are also up in the air. The federal government is looking at whether they want to allocate all the dollars that they intended to allocate into this program. Very much up in the air. But we have a motion on the table to move the LFO recommendation to defer. And I'm assuming you're in there.
To defer? Well, what's my alternative? To accept it?
You can... Well, this is an interesting position for you to be in.
It really is.
If you vote no on the deferral, then you'd have to probably make a statement about your intent.
I don't know how much more I can state. Um, I guess it's a yes. I support the deferral.
Okay. So is there any objection to the motion then? Without objection, the motion is carried, and I will take this one in the floor. Okay, call for the Parks and Recreation Department. Mr. Woods, please proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tim Wood, Director of the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. And I lost track of the agenda items. I think agenda item 30 is a request from the department for some additional limitation to use to expend some revenue, which has come to the department as a result of increases in lottery revenue since the close of the biennium. And specifically, this item requests an increase of lottery funds to move ahead with some work on our trails program. And in our request, there's a list of trails and trail programs and projects in which this $506,000 would be utilized. Also, a request for $1 million to accelerate some paving projects that we would put that $1 million into our facility investment program and help us work on reduction of the backlog in paving in the department. And the third portion is $500,000 in the additional lottery funds for investment in aesthetic, principally aesthetic improvements at the state fairgrounds. These improvements will follow on the business plan that we're putting together to improve the state fair, and these aren't significant capital investments. They're more aesthetic investments, and that's the nature of our request.
Questions or comments for the director?
Question.
Senator.
Ms. Woods, you know that I am a strong supporter of the fair, so I appreciate the marvelous job the department has done on that. However, my question is, why would you at this time decide on paving and other things that you have on here as opposed to, say, trying to buy new land for state parks?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, we have $8 million in this biennium in an acquisition program, and in the next biennium, we plan to continue our acquisition program. And in fact, one of our agency request items is to increase the funding for land acquisition for parks and recreation purposes in the next biennium. And so, at this point in the biennium, it's a question of being able to expend the dollars before the end of the biennium, and certainly one of our highest priorities also is building down the backlog, and we can do that and expend the dollars in the paving program, and that's why we've chosen to select these items.
I'm a person that really believes that you have to do infrastructure. There's no doubt about it, else things will just go. Are these emergencies at this point?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, no, they're not. It's an opportunity. We have, again, the revenue has been projected to be in our budget, and it gives us an opportunity to move ahead. The projects are essentially ready to go to bidding. So otherwise, it would be into our next biennium's program.
Thank you.
Other questions or comments? Do you have anything you want to say?
I support this fully. There are some trails in my district and some things, especially like the new Stubbs Stewart Park, and improvements that we've needed. And like I said, there's been an increase in the lottery funds. And part of the parks section of this money is maintenance and should be. We should be maintaining our parks. And I have to tell you, any kind of comments I get about parks, I'm waiting for the good ones to come, but they're all about you guys need to clean up these parks, you need to improve these trails, you need to. I'm sorry Saddle Mountain Road's not on it, but that's another issue. But no, I totally support it, and I think it's something we can do, so thank you.
Madam Chair, Lisa Pearson with DAS, we recommend that the subcommittee approve the request.
Mr. Yerke.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, LFO also recommends approval of the request.
Questions or comments on the DAS and the LFO recommendation?
Madam Chair, I so move the recommendation.
Have a motion to move the recommendation to full with a due pass. Do I have any objections? Without objection, the motion is carried. And let's move ahead to item 31. Oh, Senator, would you carry this in the full?
I'd rather not carry it. No.
Okay. Representative Boone,
I'll do it. Sure. Okay. Thanks.
Madam Chair, the next item is to request additional limitation for two specific projects that we've identified for the expenditure of revenue, which is in what is known as the Acquisition and Development Trust Fund, which is an account established within the department, which prior to this biennium has been not carried as limited money. It's continuously appropriated funds by statute. However, in the last biennium, we moved that to the limited side. So there's an account balance which has grown in there principally as a result of the trades for the acquisition of the properties which have become sub-Stewart State Park. And what we're asking to do is to use additional limitation to be able to expend some of that funds for construction work at Stubbs-Stewart State Park, and also a portion of the funds for a project to improve the drainage and do some resource protection work at Garrison Lake in Port Orford. And so that's the nature of the request is to ask for the increased limitation in other funds to be allowed to accomplish those two projects.
And we are currently lacking a quorum, so maybe we can go trolling for a senator and see if we can do something about it. Thank you.
There's one.
Would you be willing to... Oh, wait a minute. We've got to get the DAS recommendation.
Madam Chair, at least the person with DAS. DAS recommends the subcommittee approve the request.
Thank you. And can we have recommendation?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, LFO also recommends approval of the request.
Madam Chair, so will the recommendation.
I have the motion. Is there discussion on the motion? Objection to the motion. Without objection, the motion is carried. And I'll take this one. And let's move on to the boating facility grants.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The final request we have before you is a request for an increase in limitation to accept grant funds from the Oregon State Marine Board for the accomplishment of several projects which have been listed in our request here. We work with the Oregon State Marine Board in concert with their six-year plan to identify marine facilities in state parks which need improvements or which are could be new facilities as well. And since the close of the last biennium session, the Marine Board has identified some additional funding that's made available, and we would like to make use of that money in this biennium, and that's the nature of the request before you.
Questions for the Director?
Madam Chair, Lisa Pearson with DAS. DAS recommends the subcommittee approve the request.
LFO also recommends approval of the request.
Madam Chair, so move the recommendations.
Have the motion to move it to full with a due pass. A discussion? Objection? So moved. And let's give this one to Representative Boone.
I'll do it.
And thank you very much. We call forward the Department of State Lands. Welcome, Director Soliday. Please proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Louise Soliday, Director of the Department of State Lands. Our first item is item number 34, which is a request to increase the Department of State Lands federal funds expenditure limitation by $412,000. This is for a Section 6 cooperative grant. We are, as the Department of Agriculture is for the Nature Conservancy, serving as a pass-through to the Nature Conservancy. This is for a conservation easement on property in Lane County in the Coburg Hills area for the purposes of protecting Fender's blue butterfly, which is listed on the endangered species list as an endangered species. I understand that there's an agreement that's going to lead to the same result, so I'll stop there.
I think we can cut to the chase on this one and just go to the LFO recommendation.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, LFO is recommending deferral of this request until November, until the agency receives actual notice from the federal government that the award has been made.
Discussion?
So move the recommendation.
We have a motion to recommend deferral to the full committee. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Without objection, the motion carries. And I'll carry this one. And let's move on and talk about the new CARISA.
Madam Chair, hopefully it'll be the old CARISA soon.
Non-CARISA.
Item, yes, exactly. Item number 35 is a request by the Department of State Lands to increase our expenditure limitation by $18 million for the purposes of removing the remaining wreckage of the new CARISA from state lands off of the North Spit near Coos Bay. I think, as everyone knows, the new CARISA ran aground in February of 1999. There were several attempts to salvage it, sink it, that involved a whole host of actions. But in the end, a large portion of the stern remained on state lands near Coos Bay. The state filed suit in 2001 against the owners of the new CARISA, filed a trespass suit. And a Coos County jury in 2002 awarded the state $25 million, found the company guilty of negligent trespass. And the money was awarded to pay for two things, to pay for the removal of the remaining wreckage and to compensate the Common School Fund for our legal fees that we've paid as a result of the lawsuit. DSL believes it's very important that we remove this wreckage. I know there's been some other folks who have looked at that money saying, aren't there better uses for that money? The reality is that we went into court to argue for the removal, and that was the case that we were making. The jury awarded us the money so that we could pay for the removal, and so I believe it's critically important in order to have judicial credibility and integrity in the future that we follow through with the basis of our case. And secondly, there's an ongoing liability risk to the state. The new CARISA is situated, while it's not on the beach, it's close enough that there is the potential that somebody could get out there and get injured, and that would result in a lawsuit against the state. And then I think, thirdly, there's just the aesthetics reason. We are very proud of our beaches and the beauty that they provide to the state of Oregon, and this is a nothing but a rusting hunk of metal at this point. So it's our recommendation that we remove the new CARISA, and we request approval of the $18 million expenditure limitation for that purpose. With that, I'll answer questions.
I have a question. Given that this thing's been augured into the beach now for, 6 years or something like that, and the action of the weather has been upon it for that period of time, and there is a potential there for some structural instability, what happens if it they try to move it and it can't be moved?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, they are not going to try to move it. They are going to remove it. And the company that we are working with, which is Titan Maritime, which is an international salvage company, has a system of jack-up barges, and what they actually are going to do is cut the metal, put it on the barge, and salvage the metal. So nobody's going to try and pull. There is a portion of the stern that is sunk into the sand. They have a crane system on their one of the barges that they believe will be able to actually pull the bottom of the stern that is into the sand out of the sand and cut it off. If they are unable to do that, they will simply cut the metal off at the sand level and leave the remaining portion buried in the sand.
What's the language in the contract around failure of the process? What's the state's liability if the company is unable to be successfully remove it?
Madam Chair, we have not completed contract negotiations with Titan at this point, so we are still having those discussions. But a large portion of the contract amount would not be paid unless they are successful with removal. and it would be tied to there would be some amount of money tied to removal of the portion above the sand and an additional amount of money tied to removal below the sand level.
So if they're not successful in removing it, then does the state not have to pay them at all?
Madam Chair, they were, as I said, we're still in contract negotiations, but the way the contract negotiations are headed is that we would pay them some portion up front because they need to move these barges from the Gulf of Mexico over to our coast to do this removal. So we would be providing them with payment to mobilize those barges, but once they're there and begin work, they would not receive any more payment until they have completed the work.
But if they don't complete the work, then they don't get payment? Is that, does that follow from what you're saying?
Madam Chair, they would have gotten a portion of a payment, a portion of the amount
the mobilization
for mobilization.
But beyond that?
That they would not.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for asking my questions.
So the other question I have then, that part of what the company that is removing it is going to do is to sell the hull for scrap value.
Madam Chair, they're going to sell it, and the proceeds will come to the Common School Fund. So we will own the scrap metal. And, Madam Chair, just I want to mention one other thing, and I contacted you about this yesterday. Because we do not yet have the contract signed, we are perfectly comfortable with the committee leaving all of this $18 million unscheduled until we do sign the contract, and then we can work with DAS to unschedule money as we need it under according to the provisions of the contract.
Any questions? DAS's recommendation?
Madam Chair, Lisa Pearson with DAS. And our original recommendation was based on the assumption that the contract would be, to fruition. And so we would recommend at this point that the subcommittee go ahead and approve the increase of $18 million other funds expenditure limitation, but that DAS would unschedule it until such time as the contract was, in fact, finalized. And then at that point, we would reschedule half of it, which would be about $7.6 million. The other 7.6 approximately had always been assumed that it would be paid in the next biennium.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, LFO recommends approval of the request with the understanding that DAS will unschedule the full amount that they're requesting until final contract is signed and actual need is demonstrated by the agency for the funding.
Thank you.
It's a little bit different than what Lisa suggested.
Senator Carter, could you...
So move the recommendation.
Thank you. I'm going to have a motion to move the LFO recommendation to full with a do pass. Is there a discussion? Objection? Without objection, it's carried. And I think as our coastal member, we should put Representative Freeman as the carrier on this.
I like both.
Thank you very much, and we'll move on to DAS and talk about the Eugene State Office Building, although this is going to be a very short discussion. And then, members, we have a special presentation after that. So I would ask you to continue to just hang in here. Please.
Madam Chair, certain... issues have arisen regarding agenda item number 50, and the Department of Administrative Services will be working on those as requested. So we will be recommending deferral of any action on this until the November e-board.
So I would take a motion to recommend deferral to the full.
So
have the motion. Is there discussion? Objection? Without objection, the motion is carried.
And you're carrying it in full.
I'll take it.
Thank you.
And could we have the counties come forward, please? If there aren't enough chairs, we just have you pull them out of the first row and line them up there. Thank you. Mr. Rocco, Yeah, I would very much like to thank the counties for coming forward and giving us this presentation today. I think that this is what we've already talked about is an issue that has a huge impact all across the state for the schools and a very particular impact to the rural counties. And I particularly want to recognize one of the county commissioners that in my legislative district, Mr. Doug Robertson. Thank you for being here. And I will just turn the program over to you. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Ben Boswell, Wallowa County Commissioner. Let that sink in for a minute.
Yes.
And President of the Association of Oregon Counties. I think it's very appropriate that we appear this morning before the committee, the General Government Committee, because we do share governance in the state of Oregon. And the issue we bring to you today has an effect on the state. Anyone who would say it doesn't would say that ballot measure 41 is going to have no effect on counties, which we don't believe. That's why it says the fiscal impact statement on the initiative. Anyway, in 1906, the federal government made a promise to counties across the country that we would receive payments from the federal land activities on public land managed by the federal government. And as you know, the dramatic decline in the management activities on federal lands has resulted in decreased payments. What you have before you is a graph showing the effect of timber harvest in Wallowa County over the past few decades. And as you can see, it's almost zeroed out with respect to federal forest harvest. Our forest payments now are almost exclusively grazing receipts, which are still being collected through those activities. In response to this crisis, Congress passed Public Law 106-393 in the year 2000. This payment in lieu of harvest, I would call it, is actually an idea that I discussed with Andy Kerr of the Oregon Natural Resource Defense Council when he was a resident of my community. And that was some years ago. So this concept is not new. And we, again, want to come as counties and school districts before the committee and tell you what the status report is with respect to a reauthorization of that safety net. And ask that you would convey our message to the full committee.
We'd be very happy to do that.
Thank you. Doug?
Thank you. Good morning. Or is it still morning? I guess it is.
Yes.
Representative Morgan, Madam Chair, members of the committee, nice to see you this morning. It's nice to see all of you. My name is Doug Robertson. I'm a county commissioner in Douglas County. I'm president of the Association of O&C Counties. I'm a member of the National County Payments Committee and also a board member of the National Forest Counties and Schools Coalition, which was the sponsoring agency for the fly-in that recently took place last week. The fly-in was an effort to re-energize the message to Congress that Public Law 106-393 expires in a scant 2 weeks. And with it, as the information you have before you indicates, nearly a half $1 billion per biennium to the state of Oregon also expires. That is dramatic enough, but as it affects county services and particularly rural schools, it becomes even more so. The fly-in was an enormous success. You can see Eric Schmidt. If you would multiply him by 216, you would have the contingent of the fly-in that visited every one of the Senate offices and House offices in the course of 2 days, relaying the message of the help needed for particularly rural education and county services. The issue, of course, and the question is, did it do any good? And I'm happy to report several things that indicate that it did have an effect. Since we were there, Senator Larry Craig, senior senator from Idaho, who was also an original co-sponsor of the legislation, attached an amendment to the last appropriations bill that came before the Senate calling for full funding for a one-year extension. It failed, but he made the point that that amendment would be put on every appropriations bill until the end of the session. We also had a very positive signal from the administration indicating that they are now ready to join the effort in identifying an offset, over $500 million a year is the price tag of this program, and that it would not be required to be connected with the sale of Forest Service land. As you may recall, last year the administration proposal was to sell Forest Service land to fund the reauthorization. That didn't meet with a great deal of enthusiasm from the Houses of Congress, and they have backed away from that and are joining us in an effort to find the offset. That's very positive. We also increased the number of co-sponsors to 123 co-sponsors in the House and 30 in the Senate, which is far more than we had the first time around. And most recently, in fact, yesterday, we got notification from Congressman Walden that Congressman Richard Pombo, who is chairman of the House Resources Committee, has added another $50 million a year in the amendment on the FERA bill, the Forest Emergency Recovery and Rehabilitation Act. That would be dedicated to this effort as well. So did the fly-in have an impact? It did, a significant impact, and it was very timely. What is the likely scenario from this point? It is very unlikely that we're going to see any action in the next week and a half before Congress adjourns. They simply don't have the time. They have, I think, 7 or 8 appropriation bills that they will not get to, and so the bill will, in all probability, expire. The likelihood is that after the November election, there will be a lame duck session in which there will be an omnibus appropriations package, and it is our belief that the reauthorization for a one-year extension will be in that package. A one-year extension will give counties and rural school districts money through June of 2008. We are currently in the 2006-07 federal budget. We have money through June of 2007 currently. And with a one-year extension, we will have money through June of 2008. As I mentioned, I'm a member of the National County Payments Committee. We are working with the committees of jurisdiction and the leadership in both the House and the Senate in an effort to find a long-term solution so we don't have to continue to go back and lobby Congress for a one-year fix or a three-year fix or whatever it may be. And that is, there are some positive things coming out of that as well. And finally, again, I would like to just leave you with this ask, and Senator Westland is not with us right at the moment. It's our understanding that he is the liaison to the National Legislative Association. And it would be most helpful if the Oregon legislature repeat what they did in January of 2005 with a unanimous resolution supporting reauthorization, only this time join with the 6 other states in the Northwest whose congressional delegation has unanimously approved and signed on to the reauthorization, so that a joint resolution with 7 states asking for the same thing will certainly have a more powerful effect than just one. And we, with Senator Westland's approval, will work with his staff and provide information and a draft of a resolution that he can work with. So, for that, thank you very much. We appreciate the time.
Commissioner Robertson, where do we go after June of 2008?
The effort will begin in January of 2007 with the Long-Term Payments Committee working, as I said, with the committees of jurisdiction to try to put a long-term solution in place. The committee actually has drafted a solution, and it is in the hands of Congress as we speak. It involves money from the Land and Water Conservation Fund. It involves more management on the federal forest lands, and we think it's a very is a workable solution. It's going to take some time to get that point across to several members of the committees of jurisdiction, but we have so far had actually fairly good reception. So there is a plan, but it will need to be implemented fairly soon because June of 08 is tomorrow, and we thought in 2000 that, 2006, that'll never happen. It's happening. So your point, we need to work very hard. That's why the I think the a coalition of resolutions from the states that are impacted, particularly if we can encourage Arizona, New Mexico, and California to join the other seven states would be a very powerful message. Initially, Senator Feinstein, Senator Boxer were co-sponsors and supportive of the initial bill, and it's important that that they remain supportive, and we have every reason to believe they will. The issue isn't we haven't found opposition in our visits with the Senate and in the House. The problem is money. As you all know, this federal budget is buried in red ink, and everybody is looking for something, as you understand in the position you're sitting right now. And we are one of the somebody's looking for something. We're fortunate in that we had a mandatory appropriations for 6 years, and we will be looking for another one. We don't want to end up in a situation where we have a an annual appropriation and have to go back every year and fight for that. So it's going to be a it's going to be a very busy year.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, David Williams with the Oregon School Boards Association, and lest we think this is just a county issue, and I know all of you are familiar, that this is definitely a schools issue as well. $60 million over a biennium for our K-12 system in the state, and I don't need to tell you all about the tight budget situation facing our schools, that living on the margin, every dollar counts for our districts, and this is very important. But beyond the direct appropriation of dollars, and I just highlight the very last page of the presentation handed out, a picture of a school bus stuck in a on a road that's been washed out, that there are so many other impacts to our districts out in these rural counties beyond just the dollars. They need good roads to get kids to and from school. They need good public safety in those counties to ensure the safety of students, and on and on. There's another great chart about shared services in here as well. But we participated in the fly-in. I'm here instead of my state president, who couldn't make it today, David Beeson from the Silver Falls School District, who attended with me the fly-in in Washington, D.C., a very powerful event and a fabulous opportunity for us to highlight this issue as not just a county's issue but a school's issue as well.
I think that three of us here represent rural counties and are very aware of the impact that federal land holdings have on the county's ability to collect revenue and generate a productive use from the land. Our good Senator Carter represents a district in the metro part of the state up in Portland area, and so I think just for her to give her a little bit of a taste of the implication of this, Commissioner Robertson, in Douglas County, a little bit more than half of the land is owned by the federal government. Can you talk to Senator Carter about the amount of the county's budget that's tied up in the federal pass-through dollars and what we're facing if we don't have those dollars to work with?
Before you start, Madam Chair, let me say to you, I ran for state school superintendent. I'm intimately acquainted with these issues.
Oh, okay.
Well, we had a chance to meet with Senator Carter about 6 years ago when she was involved, and she does indeed have a good understanding. Multnomah County, of course, is a receiving county, and significant dollars, although not to the extent that some. But as David has pointed out, every dollar counts, and no matter what the amount, It is very important to these budgets. Our budget is dependent, about 70% of our general fund budget is dependent on this. There will be some counties that receive both the ONC safety net and the Forest Service safety net that will be teetering on insolvency if this isn't passed. David's point, again, I can't reiterate it strongly enough. The bill, 106393, is the Rural Schools and Community Self-Determination Act. Rural schools is what got the attention of Congress, and it's what keeps the attention of Congress. This is about education in rural areas. The counties, of course, are involved, but it is a desperate situation in many rural areas throughout this country. There are 42 states affected by this, 800 counties, and over 4,400 school districts. So it's not just the Pacific Northwest. We are the timber basket, of course, of the nation. So we are disproportionately impacted. But it's interesting listening to the stories from the people from the Allegheny and Pennsylvania and Texas, and of course Mississippi. We've seen what's happened down there, and the stories are very much the same. Rural education is dramatically impacted. Most states are not like Oregon. They are not equalized. They receive the 25% funds, and of course that's been a bit problematic in our situation, but we've worked through that. So, again, your help will be invaluable, particularly as it involves working with other state legislatures. That message is going to have to resonate, because in all probability the federal government's budget is not going to improve dramatically between now and the time we need to go knocking on their door again.
Thank you very much. Representative,
just ask a question, then. That's probably a stupid question, but I'll go ahead and do it anyway. Somebody has to. How can something this important get left to the last minute, and how can we bring it up, you know, have it bubble up to a higher priority for Congress in the beginning of, like, 2007 is what we're looking at now?
The answer, I think, is an interesting one, and it revolves to an extent around the leadership in the House and the Senate. The Pacific Northwest doesn't have a lot of leadership. And when you consider the leadership in the Finance Committee being from the state of Iowa, the Budget Committee being from the state of New Hampshire, and Senator Cochran from Mississippi as the chairman of the Appropriations Committee, that's not exactly a lineup of Western concerns. Nobody west of the Mississippi in a leadership position. The only leadership position we have is Senator Smith, who has a chairman of the Senate Committee on Aging, and that's it. And that's not unimportant. It certainly is. But in terms of natural resource issues, the amount of leadership we have to exert is minimal. That is not to say Senator Wyden and Senator Smith have worked very hard. In fact, without their help, we wouldn't be on the radar at all. So not a very good question. And that is, how in the world could something this important be left for so long? And it isn't as important in the state of Colorado or in the state of Missouri as it is here. And so that's there are a lot of politics involved in this.
So can we just do this thing, and it's in my district, no more Tillamook cheese or sandwiches for congressional receptions until we get higher on the list?
Yeah, right.
I've heard.
Yeah. No more Oregon wines.
No more Oregon wines.
That might do it.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
We definitely appreciate you taking time to bring this issue again to our attention. And
before you close, I'd like to say thanks to, I know the commissioner, the judge, sorry, from Grant County, and I can't remember your name, but I know I know you. Carney, sorry, whatever.
Close.
You know, it's out there. And everybody else who's come a long way to sit here. We appreciate it, even if you don't get to say much more than that. Sorry.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And having no further business before the subcommittee, this is adjourned.